Hi, and welcome to Sign of the Crime. This is Remy Ramirez.
This is Q McGrath.
This is maybe the fifth time we've tried to do this. God damn.
It's been troublesome.
Oh, fuck. You know what I forgot? It's fucking Mercury retrograde.
Oh, it's the 14th.
Yeah. No. Well, it's the 15th, but yeah, Mercury retrograde started yesterday.
Is it the 15th?
We don't know what day it is.
That it started on the 14th.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't remember exactly what it was, but there was someone I do some like spiritual shit with. And she was like, you're going to be okay come February 3rd. She was like, but just stay in bed till then. And I was like, and then I was looking things up and I was like, oh, I think that that's when Mercury retrograde is over.
Well, and you, because we're also in Venus retrograde and you in Capricorn. Oh,
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
It's this Venus retrograde has been a fucking doozy for me. So I can only imagine how it's been for you since your cap.
2019, 2020 were some of the worst years of my life. And then 2021 was like, but I do know from looking at some of the astrology that coming up after February of this year, shit's supposed to get just a whole
so much better.
Lot easier for me.
Yes. Well, and also for me, because I've had the South Node in Sagittarius for the last 2 years, you can get the fuck out of my fucking...
Time to go. Don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Well, but yeah, the South Node is like, cool, I'll just move right over into Scorpio where you have a stellium.
That's cool. That's also my fucking Venus sign. So
yeah, my Venus, my Mercury, my Uranus. Yeah, get out of my life. And then it's going to be like bloop, bloop, bloop on into Libra where you have another stellium.
Oh, I was going to say that's your rising. So fun for you.
No, it's my moon. But yeah, get the fuck out, dude.
Wait, okay. So Gemini's your rising. I always think Libra's your rising, but it's
because
Gemini.
Because I'm like so Libra.
But that's because Libra is Michael's rising.
Oh, yeah.
Leo
it's like so his rising.
It's so his rising. A Leo with a Libra rising, but a Virgo moon.
Yes,
but a Virgo moon. Woof. And that's why he'll be like, I'm fine, while he's scrubbing the bottom of floors and then mad at you when you're not like properly, you know,
attending to his ego.
Yes, essentially. Yeah. We call it petting the kitty.
Speaking of nothing that we're talking about right now, I would like to talk about our idea of doing true crime ASMR.
But I'm going to bring up the point I brought up before, which is that I think it's counterproductive. Like,
he stabbed her slowly.
Several
so
times.
Creepy. Oh my God, don't do it. No, but also, okay.
To her butt. Like,
I get it. As someone who is religious about her ASMR every night, and also
it's so weird. That's the creepiest shit I've ever heard, is walking past your room and hearing like all fucking night long. I'm like, nope, thank you.
One time I stayed at Cheryl's house. Cheryl is a good friend of our families. Like, we've known her since we were tiny itty bitty. And I had my ASMR going, and she came to my door in the morning to ask me if I like wanted coffee or something. And I was still asleep and my ASMR was still going. And she was like, I was going to ask you if you wanted some coffee, but I think you were praying. I was like, no. And when I told her what it was, she was like, oh my God, actually, I was very creeped out by it, but I didn't want to say that. And I was like, yeah, sorry. I know. It is creepy.
It is creepy. And Cheryl, now we have a true crime podcast. And then we talk about their fucking astrology, and that's not creepy. So don't be worried about us.
Speaking of Cheryl, she was the one who was like, you have to do the Menendez brothers because she's so
You should send her the episode.
I did. Yeah. She was super excited about it.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
She was like, I'm not really into true crime, but that fucking case was wild.
That case was wild.
It was wild.
Speaking of,
speaking of wild, I do want to talk about Ted Bundy. Let's hear it, girl. You have a novella over there to share with us.
Yeah. We might just end up doing my part today, depending on how long this goes, because it's going to go. I'm going to start out by saying there's a lot of documentary shit about Bundy out there.
Yeah.
But one actually I think that you would like was called Falling for a Killer. And I think it's on Amazon Prime, and you have my Prime, so you can watch it if you want.
I do mooch off your Prime. Thank you very much.
And it's 4 episodes. And like, a couple of years ago, everybody was talking about Bundy again, because that Zac Efron film came out at the same time that the Bundy tapes came out, and it's really interesting. So the Bundy tapes are very good. I'm not taking anything away from it. There's lots of information there. it has a very masculine feel to it. Falling for a Killer.
I know this. I watched this documentary. It's the one.
So did you watch it?
By a woman
about the women looking from their point of view.
Yes. And through the lens of his girlfriend.
Yeah.
I watched it, Quintana, and I watched it right when the pandemic started, and I was all by myself in Tucson for like 6 weeks, and I was staying in some weird fucking house that I didn't know very well. And I like, literally I was,
that was a poor choice.
it was better than getting COVID. Which was like my other choice at the time. It was like, stay here in this weird house or go get COVID.
I mean, no, I don't mean that. I mean, the staying arrangements were what they were. I'm talking about watching a Bundy documentary.
Oh, it's a terrible choice. Oh my God.
Not a good idea.
A couple of fun facts about it. I put a huge boulder in front of the door. There was a big boulder in the house for some reason. I moved it in front of the fucking front door. Then I went
to desert culture.
Then I went to bed in the bedroom and put a chair under the doorknob in the bedroom. And then I got sick the next day because my immune system fucking dropped out because I got so fucking stressed out by this documentary.
I was going to say, you do that. You get stressed out about this shit to the point where you get sick, which is like, I can't believe you were like, I know. I'm freaked out and scared. And this is a really scary time because of this rampant disease that's going wild. I think I'm just going to watch this really cozy little documentary about a guy who killed a lot of women while I'm alone in this place. This could be fun.
You know, I have no impulse control. You know this.
Okay, Gemini rising.
You know, I'm like, sounds like a bad idea.
Let's see what the consequences are. I'm sick.
Yeah. I'm like, how many fucking like vitamin C gummies can I take till I get sick to my stomach? Let's find out.
26.
He's so delicious. Now I'm barfing. I'm telling you, sort of.
It's not. You should do it with if you're going to do that, do it with the probiotic ones, because all that will happen is that you'll poop.
Sounds great. Yeah. Probiotic gummies on it.
Yeah.
I just want to have gummies. I just want to live off of gummies.
And you can buy the organic ones for like $5 a bottle at Walmart, and then you can just poop.
Okay. We're not advertising WM on here.
I mean, I'm not advertising it, but
also you live
in
the middle of nowhere. So it's like the only store.
That's true. Yeah. That and Kroger. So
ew,
that's why I drive. But that's why I drive. People think I'm insane. People were like, you're not going to do this after 6 months, 5 years strong, bitch. And once a week I drive 70 miles each way so that I can go to Whole Foods and TJ's, which is, it's just the California.
Also, you're just trying to get away from your family for a minute. So that's,
But yes, that absolutely was true when they were here. But now he's in LA and they're in school. I just like the drive. I've always liked the drive.
She loves
it. But also, I also like food that, you know, isn't covered in plastic. So totally. It's a weird thing I have. But anyway, so about Bundy, if y'all out there are interested, the Zac Efron movie was not terrible, actually. And what I liked about it was that it sort of made you like, you empathize with Bundy. Like you're like, because they don't show his crimes. They really show like, if you were Liz Klepfer, what you were kind of seeing, which was this dude that was just hot and like into
so
you.
Hot.
Yeah. And
so
it,
crazy.
It isn't until the end that you're like, oh, and he does this one thing and you're like, oh, right. You killed a bunch of people. And then the Bundy tapes, a lot of really good information, a lot of stuff where you're like, oh, wow, they said that out loud. And then I just can't recommend enough Falling for a Killer. Because when I saw it, like, oh, so good. But I was just like, this feels like, I don't know, like a bad Hallmark movie. I mean, the title, I was like, Falling for a Killer. Really? You could have done better than that. Yeah. But it was so good. It was so good.
So well done.
So well done. And it looked at, I mean, also the part where his brother was talking. So
my God, heartbreaking.
Not only that, he sounds like him.
Oh, he
so
does?
If you watch the Bundy tapes, there's a lot of Bundy in it because they filmed that trial, that first trial, like filmed it. It was on television. It wasn't like a major motion picture, but it was on television.
Yeah.
And he sounds, the first time I heard his voice, I was in the kitchen. I was like, the fuck? Because it sounded like Bundy. And I realized, I forgot he had siblings, but he did.
Sadly.
Well, sadly for them. I mean, they seem like nice. His brother seems like a nice person who's haunted forever.
Haunted forever. Lives in a fucking tiny
van.
Cannot get his fucking life together at all.
Yeah. No, it
I would change my name.
Yeah. I mean, everyone else associated with the case did. Literally everyone, yeah. You know?
What happened anyway. To his daughter? That's what I want to know.
From what I, okay, so I looked it up. And because I am insane and have a LexisNexis account and will literally snoop on it till 2 a.m. to find things out I want to know about people. Hi, Scorpio, in your chart. What I can tell you is that I'm pretty sure she's in Great Britain and that she seems to be very normal.
Lovely, lovely woman.
Just a very normal person.
Well, so, Rose Bundy, wherever you are, we wish you Bundy. The best. Oh,
I guarantee she changed that name. Yeah. I guarantee you. Okay, so Robert Theodore Bundy was actually born Theodore Robert Bundy was born Theodore Robert Cowell on November 24th. So he's a Sag.
We know.
With me.
Shut up. Get out of here.
1946. He's a psychopath also. So that might have more to do with anything than his sign. But,
well, you know, we'll get there. You can talk your shit now. We'll get there.
Hey, I'm sorry. I don't get a lot of these opportunities.
It's true. Sag is like the best sign. So it's hard to
touch. No, that's not what I meant. So, so he was born in Burlington, Vermont to Elizabeth Lund. To Louise Cowell at the Elizabeth Lund unwed mother's home. And there was no father listed on the birth certificate. Oh. So there have been a lot of rumors about who Ted Bundy's father could have been. His mother once claimed she was seduced by a war veteran named Jack Worthington, it just sounds like a romance novel. But there are friends and family who will swear up and down that he was actually fathered by his own grandfather, Samuel Cowell. So we're hoping that's not true, but it's a possibility.
Yeah. So wait, question. Where did you get that?
It's in the Bundy tapes.
Interesting.
One of his family friends was like, this is what the talk was. This is what everybody thought.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. We won't know. I mean, he's dead now.
And well, there's some shit in his chart, but yeah, keep going.
Really? Shocking.
no, but I mean about that.
Okay. Yeah, well, I can't wait to hear about it. What we do know is that he was originally left at the home. And then when Eleanor, who everyone calls Louise, returned home to Philadelphia without her newborn baby, her father told her to turn her ass around and get that baby, which she did.
Oof.
Yeah. Bundy lived with his grandparents for the first 3 years of his life, and they raised him as their own in order to avoid the stigma of having a grandchild born out of wedlock. Ugh, nothing worse. Both of his grandparents were alcoholics. They were both mentally ill. Mm. His grandmother was a depressive who was occasionally treated with electroconvulsive therapy. Mm. And she developed agoraphobia, which, in case you don't know,
you can't go outside.
Right. She didn't want to leave the house. That happened later in her life. His grandfather was a violent, tyrannical bigot who talked aloud to people who weren't there. So I'm going to go ahead and say that the apple didn't fall too far from that particular tree. Mm-hmm. Not a great start for Bundy. He believed that his mother was his sister for a while until he was told otherwise. I don't actually know how long he believed that.
Can you imagine one day?
Like, psych. Like,
you're like 12. Like, what?
Well, I mean, it couldn't have been that long because we'll get there. Okay. He did discover his birth certificate at a relatively young age, and he was pretty resentful for the rest of his life about being lied to about his parentage because it does list that there's no known father. Mm. So that was bad. It probably didn't help. And fair enough. You know, he's upset about that. Okay. I don't think it justifies anything, but all right. Totally. As a young child, he demonstrated troubling behavior, including hurting animals and young children in his neighborhood. He liked to set up what he referred to as tiger traps, which were actually sharpened sticks in a pit with vegetation over them to cover them up so they could trap tigers. But actually what they trapped were children. And once his younger sister, Julia, reported waking up being surrounded by knives and her brother standing next to the bed smiling at her. So that's pretty creepy.
Wow. You did a lot of shit, but you never did anything like that.
Yeah, no, I'm mean, but I'm not a psychopath.
it's true.
So in 1950, when he was 4, he moved with his mother's sister to Tacoma, Washington, where she met and married Johnny Culpepper Bundy. So that was actually the name for this poor dude. It's his stepdad.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's rough for him. Yeah. So but he was, by all reports, a really good man who did his best to be a good father to Ted. They had four more children. They were very Leave It to Beaver. Johnny legally adopted Ted. Both of his parents went out of their way to create a happy childhood for these kids, Ted included. He was not appreciative of their kindness, however, and he frequently talked about how much he did not relate to his stepfather, claiming that he wasn't very bright and he didn't make very much money.
Wait, Bundy said this about his stepdad.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He's like, you're dumb, sir.
he's like, he's don't like, care for you.
You're a fucking idiot. You don't know how to murder a bunch of people.
Maybe that was his standard. I don't know. From the beginning, he was different. He actually, when if you watch the Bundy tapes, he talks about his childhood in idyllic terms for the most part. And he does admit to being like a loner, you know, as he got older, but he very much makes it sound as if that was his choice. But in other interviews, he admits to canvassing the neighborhood as an adolescent, looking to spy on naked women in windows.
Okay.
Searching trash cans for pornographic magazines.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So
yeah, these are red flags.
These are some super big red flags.
If you're listening to this and your son is doing this shit,
it's therapy time.
It's time for therapy, honey.
Yeah.
Don't ignore that. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No.
Red flag. Waving itself.
Waving itself. Yeah.
Yeah. So despite his family taking the time to enroll him in sports and send him to camps, he just never really gelled with that kind of like red-blooded American male stereotype. He wanted to, but he wasn't athletic and he wasn't very popular. And by his own admission, that's my favorite part of this. He's like, I had trouble relating to people. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an understatement. Yeah. So he got in a little bit of trouble, a couple of misdemeanors in high school, but as is normal in Washington State, his record was expunged when he turned 18. So he went into adulthood with a clean slate. He graduates in 65 and he ended up in the University of Washington in Seattle, where he meets a woman named Diane, who was beautiful, confident, from a wealthy family in California, and by his own admission, way out of his league. And that tortured him terribly. He couldn't afford to take her out the way she was accustomed to being squired around. He couldn't afford to hobnob with the influential people her family knew. And eventually the romance kind of fell apart. Diane told people that he wasn't assertive enough for her. And in fact,
he's about to be, honey.
She described him as meek and timid.
Well, yeah.
It's not funny, but it is.
I mean, I'm laughing because I'm nervous and sad and scared.
Yeah. So in 68, he drops out of school and he worked for Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign and then attended the Republican National Convention because the man was a Republican.
Okay.
And it was.
And that's on being a Republican.
And that's on. And you know what, ladies, that those shirts, I don't fuck Republicans. This is why. When people ask why, Bundy was a Republican, then walk away.
What else do you need to know?
That's it. That's all you need to know. So it's shortly after that experience that Diane ended the relationship, citing his immaturity. Well done, girl. And so Bundy is all mopey and sad. So he travels to Colorado. No, my computer is just like, I know what you meant. You do not.
Florida.
No. Then he returns to Washington. So
wait, where did he go?
Colorado.
Okay.
Colorado.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
Okay.
So, and then he goes back to Washington and this is where he meets Liz Klopfer. And I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Her name is different now, for obvious reasons. Yeah. She changed her name. Mm-hmm. So she's a divorcee with a daughter. She falls very much in love with him. He falls in love with her.
And also an ex-Mormon.
Love. Yeah.
She, yeah. And I honestly think that's important because I think I'm going to say this and this is controversial. I'm going to fucking
I was
say
like, it. Oh, you're going to fucking 10 people are going to log off right now.
Yeah. But I'm going to say it. Because I think it's true. And I think it needs to be said in any kind of system that teaches women to be obedient. You are setting them up to fucking fail in this world. When you are teaching women not to push back or to know their place or to be subservient in any way. And
you're preaching the choir.
You are setting them up to be taken advantage of by narcissists, to not be able to fucking handle their lives when they get outside of that system, which already is taking advantage of them. I'm not saying that all Mormons are this way. And I actually had a lovely conversation with a Mormon woman who identifies as a feminist. And she was so smart and it was so interesting. So I don't think it's like, I don't think it's every single person, but what I'm saying is be aware of systems that ask women to be subservient because you are you are stripping them of their ability to empower themselves, and you are setting them up to get into fucked situations with narcissists. And I think
let's be clear. It's not just Mormonism. It's actually most religions.
Yes.
You know? I mean, most organized religions are very clear about what they think women's places are, and it's not at the top, you know, any context.
And it's reflected in the fact that when you look at religions, you don't see women in positions of power. But this is how respect is subjective, but positions of power are not. And this is how you can see how it works. If you don't see women at the helm, then you know that they're not allowing women to have power, and you know that they are therefore teaching women to be subservient. Okay. I'll get off my soapbox.
I can't think of any major religion that allows women in positions of power.
Not even Islam.
I was going to say, if I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, no, I've studied this.
I can't think of one. And that,
I think there are some like subsects, they're like maybe the Unitarian Church.
Well, yeah, I'd have to look into that. I don't know. Well, as it applies here, we're about to talk about an example of how a woman who had no idea of her own personal power really let herself get fucked over in a very real way. So they formed this little family for actually a fairly long time, a number of years, well into when his legal troubles started. So he starts dating her in 1970, and he re-enrolls at the University of Washington, this time as a psych major, which is a little on point, I feel. And yeah, he seemed to be pulling his life together. So he's an honor student. He worked at the Suicide Hotline Crisis Center.
Lol.
Pretty sure that's where he met Ann Rule. He lived a fairly normal life. So he graduates in 72. He dabbles in politics. He's working for the Republican governor's reelection campaign. That governor appoints Bundy to the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, which is where he picks up some inside information about how police operate and how, should you decide to become a serial murderer, to avoid detection. It turned out to be a very useful position for him.
Yeah. You think?
A little bit. So after that governor's reelected, he was hired as an assistant to Ross Davis, chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. Again, the man's a Republican. I just feel like that can't be repeated enough.
Alienating everybody today.
I know. Sorry. But like, Jesus fucking Christ. I think it's because like, this is, you know, it's the 60s, 70s, free love, you know, like,
right.
And everybody was like, it's going to get you killed. I'm like, by Republicans. Let's be clear. It's getting you killed by these guys, Republicans. So in 1973, he's accepted into law school in Utah and the University of Puget Sound, mostly on the strength of his recommendation letters from his Boston professors, because his LSAT scores were trash.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. So before starting school at the University of Puget Sound, he heads on out to California on official Republican Party business, and he hooks up with Diane again. Is he still dating Liz Clifford? He sure is. But Diane is very impressed with his transformation into a law student with a political future, and they begin dating again. Again, is he still dating Liz? Yes, he absolutely is. So he's trash on top of everything else. So neither women are aware of the other woman's existence. Yeah. And in the fall of 73, he starts law school at the University of Utah. Oh, no. He starts... No, not at the University of Utah. We'll get there. He starts law school at the University of Puget Sound. So Diane flies out to see him several times. They discuss marriage. He introduces her as his fiance to people. And then in January of 1974, he fucking ghosts her. And this shit gets weird. So he breaks off all contact with her. All of her phone calls and her letters go unreturned. And so finally she reaches him by phone like a month later. And she's like, what the fuck? What is happening? How are you just like universally, just like unilaterally ending this relationship without any kind of an explanation? And apparently he said in a very flat, calm voice, Diane, I have no idea what you mean, and hung up the phone, and she never heard from him again. So he later told people, I quote, I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her. But she decides that in retrospect, he probably had planned the entire courtship and rejection as vengeance for the breakup that she initiated in 68.
Totally.
So that's not weird at all.
That's in his chart. 100%.
Yeah. I was kind of like, part of me was impressed until we get to the killing, but I was like, wow, damn, like you really committed to that. Okay. So here's where I'm going to start talking about the murders. And I want to start with this. We don't know how many people Ted Bundy killed or when he started killing. He was never clear with law enforcement or journalists about exactly when all this started. He was very mercurial about it from the very beginning. He's intimated at times that he might have begun at least attempting as early as 1968. Criminal profilers believe that there is a very real possibility he started as early as his teenage years. But the murders that we know of began in 1974 when he was 27 years old.
Saturn returns.
That's right. His Saturn returns. So January 4th, 1974, he breaks into the basement apartment of Karen Sparks, where he beats and then rapes her with a metal rod, leaving her for dead. She survived with permanent physical and mental injuries. February 1st, 1974, he breaks into the basement room of Linda Healy, beats her unconscious, dresses her, and takes her. I don't believe they ever found her body. I don't know. Well, there was a lot of things we'll get into it. So between March and June of 1974, Donna Manson, Susan Rancourt, Roberta Parks, and Carol Ball all disappear in Washington State, all college students, all young. Witnesses report for Susan Rancourt and Carol Ball that before their disappearance, they were seen talking to a man with his arm in a sling. June 11th, 1974, Georgianne Hawkins is kidnapped by Bundy in a brightly lit alley. He knocks her unconscious with a crowbar, handcuffs her, strangles her, takes her body to Issaquah, and then he spends the night with her corpse. Interestingly, he left an earring and a shoe of hers in a nearby parking lot, and then he went back to collect them the next morning in the middle of a major police investigation.
God, wow.
Yeah.
They were like, excuse me, sir. This is a crime scene. And he's like, oh, but I'm white. I'm a white man. And they're like,
I'm a white dude. And that has never been more true than it was in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Like, from what I understand, he actually gave a little information about Georgianne Hawkins in the Bundy tapes. He talks about it. And he says that he was wearing some kind of a cast or something. I think maybe it was a leg cast, and he had this big briefcase, and he asked her to help him put it in his car. And then he knocked her unconscious and, you know, did what he did, handcuffed her, put her in the car. But he's seen in this instance, and he is identified as a man in a leg cast driving a VW Bug. So at this time, he's working as the assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, where he writes a pamphlet on rape prevention.
It's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
I mean,
it's intentional.
It's absolutely intentional, but it's also like he just looked like the kind of guy who wouldn't. And that's what people kept saying. Like at the trial, he had fucking groupies showing up who were like, I wish I could say I was kidding about this, but because he had a preference, he liked slender white women with dark hair, long dark hair parted in the middle.
Oh, I
women would dress I would up. Be,
that's literally me.
Yeah. Well, straight hair, but you know, okay. It was you in the 2000s, and women would show up at his trials dressed like that, with their hair like that, and be like dressing. I was like, what's happening? What's going on here? Anyway. So he also worked at the Department of Emergency Services, the DES, which is a state government agency involved in the search for missing women.
Yes.
This is where he met and he dated Carol Ann Boone. And you're going to want to remember that name because it's going to resurface. So at this point, the media is going absolutely wild. Law enforcement is being pressured to make an arrest. Women are no longer hitchhiking. None of those things are happening.
None of them. Wait, question. So from where we are now to when the first murder happened that you talked about, how much time has passed?
Not much. So 72. So a couple of years.
It's been a couple of years. Okay.
Yeah. So I think he started in 72. Is that right? Let me check.
I'm just trying to gauge how far into this we are.
Oh, no, we're not far. We're 6 months. 74.
Okay. Six months.
So yeah, we're about 6 months.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. So he turned 27. So he's a Sag. So he turned 27 in December, and then he starts for real in January the following year.
He's like, this is my birthday. I'm going to take a little time off for my birthday. I'm going to do me, and then we'll get right back into it.
And then we're just going to jump back into it. Yeah. Well, when that Saturn return hits hard.
He's like, self-care.
Shit hits hard.
Self-care. Okay. And then I'm back.
Got to do what I got to do. It's about me. So there is a dearth of physical evidence, and all the police really have to go on in these cases is that it's a youngish man wearing a cast or a sling, driving a brown or a tan VW Bug. And that's all they got. And it's in the middle of all this that July 14th, two women go missing from Lake Sammamish Park. I swear to God, some of these things, I'm like, you're trying to do this to me on purpose. Lake Sammamish?
Sammamish.
What is that? In Issaquah. Fuck, dude. All right. So again, a young man in a sling and a white tennis outfit is seen asking for help unloading like a sailboat or a catamaran from his VW bug. But this time he introduces himself as Ted. Four women refuse. I think it's probably a red flag that he keeps asking women, but okay. So four women refuse. One agrees to help. And as she gets close to the car and she sees there's no sailboat or catamaran, she pieces the fuck out. And then he approaches Janice Ott, a 23-year-old caseworker at the King County Juvenile Court, and she's seen leaving with him. 4 hours later, 19-year-old Denise Naslin left a picnic with friends to go to the bathroom, and she never comes back. So Bundy eventually tells a crime profiler that Janice Ott was alive when he returned with Denise Naslin and that he forced one to watch while he murdered the other. But then he later denied that. And Bundy did like messing with people, so we'll never actually know what happened there. So now the cops have a really decent description of this guy and a name. So they post flyers everywhere throughout Seattle. Bundy's girlfriend, Liz, who is still dating him, and his coworker, Ann Rule. She was a coworker, yes, at the DES, the Department of Emergency Services, and his professors all call the police, reporting Ted Bundy as someone who matches this description of a suspected murderer. But the police dismiss this possibility because they just don't find it likely that this clean-cut college student who worked in law enforcement and for the Republican Party with no adult crime record was a murdering sack of shit. So in addition to that... So the witnesses from the Lake Sammamish incidents failed to identify him as the Ted they had seen in a police lineup. So he is getting lucky. In September, the skeletal remains of Ott and Naslund are found near a service road close to the park where they had been kidnapped, as well as the femur and the vertebra of Georgianne Hawkins. 6 months later, more remains are found on Taylor Mountain. And the remains that were found were eventually discovered to be those of Susan Rancourt, Linda Healy. Okay, so they did find Linda Healy's body and Roberta Parks. Donna Manson's remains have never been found, but it's a safe bet they're somewhere in that area. Oh, they also found Brenda Ball. So this is like, now we're people are like, what the fuck? Because women's bodies are showing up everywhere. So in August of 74, Ted inexplicably gets another acceptance from the University of Utah's laws program, which is crazy because he basically just stopped attending class. Murdering was taking up a lot of his time. So he was not doing well at UPS's law school. Murdering gets in the way of studying. But he did get in again at the Utah program, and shit's getting a little complicated for him in the Pacific Northwest. So he moves to Utah, which was very unfortunate for Utah. He continues his relationship with Liz Klopfer, but he dates at least half a dozen other women while in Utah because he's a murdering sack of shit and a dog, which might have been a distraction from the fact that he wasn't doing well in law school there either. So he admits later in interviews that he was, quote, devastated to find out that the other students had some intellectual capacity that he did not. He found the classes completely incomprehensible. It was, quote, a great disappointment to me. Yeah. That's what he was thinking about.
It's also just real. That's really interesting to me. You know, I didn't expect that.
I expected him to be smarter, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Most of the time I'm always, I don't know if amazed is the right word, but when we do these things so many of the times when I'm reading about these murderers, they're geniuses and they can figure out anything.
Right.
But this guy, and he got away with so much.
But it sounds like a lot of it was just because he was hot and white.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And lucky. Wait till I tell you. So he's killing again in Utah. On September 2nd, he raped and strangled an as of yet unidentified hitchhiker in Idaho. On October 2nd, he kidnapped Nancy Wilcox in Holiday, Utah. Her remains have not been found as of yet. On October 18th, 17-year-old Melissa Smith, who was the daughter of a police chief, disappeared, and her body was found in a nearby mountainous area, showing evidence that she might have been alive for up to a week following her disappearance.
Oh my God.
Which, if so, is very strange because he didn't normally do that.
But I wonder if she was out there dying.
Maybe. It's possible. He also, at some point, talks about the possibility that he would kidnap women, which is why we'll never know exactly how many there were. But he said that he would kidnap women, bring them into the woods, go back to his car to get his tools, come back. And sometimes they were gone. And, you know, maybe they woke up, ran away,
but couldn't get very far. Right.
Right. You never know. So Laura Amy, also 17, went missing in Lehi, Utah, and her body was found about 9 miles away on Thanksgiving Day. Mm. She had been her and Melissa Smith had both been raped, beaten, sodomized, and strangled with nylon stockings. Later, Bundy would reveal that he had postmortem rituals with these bodies, wherein he would shampoo their hair and apply makeup. Carol DeRanche is where Bundy fucked up. So he got a little cocky. Carol's at a mall. She's doing a little window shopping when Bundy approaches her and tells her that her car has been broken into. And does she want to come with him and identify the car and see if anything has been stolen? So she goes with him and she's a little wary, especially when he keeps asking her to get closer to the car and see if anything's missing. She says everything's there. So he tells her that the car thief is in custody. And if she wants to accompany him to the station to make a complaint, now's the time. She asks for some ID and he shows it to her. Interesting. He had some kind of police identification. So they go to his car, which is his VW bug. And that seems odd to her, but she gets in. She says in interviews later that she figured maybe he was undercover and he begins driving in the wrong direction. And she points that out. And at this point, she's a little panicky and he pulls off the road, tries to handcuff her, but he got both handcuffs on the same wrist. And he told her, she said that he told her something along the lines of, shut up or I'm going to kill you. And she was like, go ahead. Like, no, basically she told him to fuck off. So they struggle. She manages to escape the car and she runs into a nearby road, stopping a passing car, jumping in the backseat, you know, losing her mind, screaming, sobbing. Of course, Bundy drives off, but he's so upset and angry about that failed kidnapping attempt that later that same evening, he kidnaps Deborah Kent on her way out of her, well, not of her, but out on the way out of a high school theater production.
And doesn't he do the same, or doesn't he do something similar, or he like,
this is kind of, I mean, he does this all the time. This is kind of his go-to.
Right. It's another, like, I'm in a sling or your car is broken into or something.
We don't know. We don't know what he did because no one saw him do it. And she died. So don't know.
Okay.
But we do know it was him because they found the handcuff keys that belonged to the handcuffs used on Carol DeRanche outside the auditorium. Mm. So in November, with reports that women are going missing in and around Utah, Liz Klepfer calls the police again. And she's like, hey,
she's like, I may be Mormon, but I know a thing or two about shitty dudes.
Yeah. She's like, I don't want to rain on y'all's parade of assuming that this is like an outsider or a Mexican or a black person, but I'm fairly certain that this is my boyfriend.
Whose name is Ted, who drives a fucking VW bug. You fucking idiots.
And then she does it again in December. She calls again in December and they basically give her the runaround. They add his name to the list of suspects, but there's no evidence. So nothing happens.
Well, and this is another thing that they talk about in Falling for a Killer, is that she was this very sweet sort of
meek. She was submissive,
very submissive woman. And so no one was taking her and it's all these dudes running the fucking programs.
There was a lot of, we got this little lady.
Yeah. It's like, okay, sweetie. Okay, honey. It's like, okay, you fucking idiot.
She actually said, I just watched this and my mouth dropped all the way to the floor, that her father, she talked to her father about it. He's like, you have to stop doing this because you're going to ruin Ted's life.
Yeah. Her fucking dad.
Yeah.
I'm just like, these patriarchal structures that don't value women, they're not going to fucking listen to you, especially if you're showing up in a meek way, which is bullshit. But anyway, I'm angry. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm fucking mad.
Like, I picked up on it. Yeah.
Give women power. Also take women seriously. Also, we need women in positions of power.
Also, can we just hearken a little back to our very first episode of Eileen Wuornos, where I'm like, no, I kind of get it. Like,
yeah.
You know, at a certain point, I kind of get it. Okay. So we can talk about how I understand women killing later. So Bundy returns to Seattle after his finals and he spends a week with Liz, and then they make plans to see each other in Salt Lake City in August. Cause people keep telling her, men keep telling her, like, nah, it's not him. And she's like, yay. So
she's like, you know reality better than I do.
So on January 12th, 1975, Karen Campbell disappears from a well-lit hallway at the Wildwood Inn in Snowmass Village, Colorado, which is Colorado. My mouth is not great today, which is about 400 miles outside of Salt Lake. So what did I write here? Oh, her body is found a month later with blunt force damage to her head and deep cuts. There's a lot of, like, they say deep cuts or deep lacerations. And I feel like what they're not saying is that, that he tried to cut her head off, or that her throat was slit so badly. Like, I feel like they're trying to not say that, but it, the way that it's phrased, I'm like, deep cuts. Okay. I get that vibe. So on March 15th, ski instructor Julie Cunningham is snatched up in Vail, Colorado on her way to dinner with a friend. Bundy later admitted that he approached her on crutches, asked her for help. Then he knocked her unconscious, assaulted her, and strangled her. He revisited her body several weeks later, which was a thing he did a lot.
So weird.
Denise Oliverson disappeared from Grand Junction while riding her bike to her parents' house on April 6th. And then on May 6th, Bundy lured 12-year-old Lynette Culver away from her junior high in Pocatello, Idaho, then drowned her and sexually assaulted her in his hotel room before disposing of her body in a river.
So is this one of his younger victims?
Yes.
He generally
chose women, young women, but women above the age of 18. I think his, like, he kind of lurked around colleges.
Right.
But a couple of times he went pretty young, and I don't know that he ever revealed why.
Well, and the other thing that I remember from the documentary is that his girlfriend had a daughter, and mm-hmm. she was around that girl's age. And that mm-hmm. girl, I remember her saying in the documentary that he never,
Molly, her name was Molly.
Molly saying that he never, like, assaulted her or was
very tender with her.
Yeah. He was very sweet with her, but she did say one time they were playing hide and go seek, and he was hiding under a sheet. And when she grabbed the sheet off of him, he was naked. So there was one weird fucking
time.
Yeah.
That's off. Yeah.
That's off. That's not right.
She's that's like, not right at all.
She's like, huh, penis.
Nope. No, thank you. Puts the sheet back on, walks away.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. So in August or September of 75, Bundy is baptized into the Mormon church.
Lol.
Look, they recruited him.
I don't even have to say it. I don't even have to say it. So I'm going to say that I don't have to say it. Keep going.
Okay. Well, you're going to love this then. He was supported by them throughout his first trial, which turns out is fast approaching.
Mm-hmm.
So law enforcement is desperate, and they are befuddled despite the fact that his girlfriend keeps calling in with his name. They're like, damn it, if only we could find this dude. So they did what was considered an innovative investigation technique, and they compiled a database inputting all the info that they have. So out of the thousands of possible suspects, they narrowed it down to about 126 of which showed up on four of the lists that they had compiled. And Bundy's name is on that list. And as he's about to be investigated, Washington state authorities get word that he's been arrested in Utah. Guess what he's arrested for?
Oh, I don't know. Is it rape and murder?
Speeding.
Mm-hmm.
So on August 6th,
they're like, hey, excuse me, white man with a bloody machete in your back seat. You are speeding, sir.
A back seat is involved. So on August 16th, 1975, he's arrested in Granger, Utah, after a highway patrol officer sees him cruising through a residential area late at night. And then he speeds away when he sees the cop car. The cop's like, well, that's not right. So the cop gets him out of the car, notices that the front seat has been removed. And when he searches the car, he finds a ski mask, a mask made out of pantyhose, handcuffs, trash bags, rope, an ice pick, and burglary tools.
Just a chill little overnight bag. Just a little first aid kit.
You know, everybody blows off steam in different ways.
Sometimes with an ice pick. Sometimes
with an ice pick.
With a ski mask. You know,
who hasn't wanted to ice pick someone? Not me. So Bundy tries to explain away the mask and the hat and the handcuffs, stating that the masks are for skiing, which I don't do a lot of skiing, but I know people that do.
Literally never seen someone fucking skiing down a mountain. A fucking
how terrifying that would be.
What the fuck?
I was skiing. Like, oh, shit. Just fly.
Oh, my God. I'm flying down the mountain. Everyone's like running, terrified, screaming.
Oh, my God. I'm just trying to imagine, like, how do you keep a straight face when you tell someone? It's for when I ski. Anyway, okay. So, and he says he's just found the handcuffs and the rest is just normal stuff.
It's just normal ice picks, sir.
Just normal ice picks. I honestly, I don't know what an ice pick's for. Like, I live in the snow. I've never needed an ice pick.
Sir, I need these nylon pantyhose for my normal everyday life. Okay? Just not, don't question me, sir.
Well, the cops are not buying it. So they search his apartment and they find a guide to a Colorado ski resorts with a check mark by the Wildwood Inn and a brochure that advertised the view. By the way, so remember the Wildwood Inn, that's where one of his victims was kidnapped from. And a brochure that advertised the Viewmont High School play where Deborah Kent had disappeared. But they missed a hidden collection of Polaroids he'd taken of his victims. So they didn't have enough evidence to hold him, and he's released. As soon as he gets out, the first thing he does is destroy those pictures. But he's on their radar now. So the Salt Lake City police place Bundy on 24-hour surveillance, and they interview Liz. They're like, hey, call that chick back.
You know that idiot woman, because all women are idiots. You know that idiot
woman who told us about this dude like a long ass time ago, three times. You know. We should talk to her. So she gives them a lot of troubling information. She tells them, well, while visiting him in Utah, she found crutches, a meat cleaver that was not used for cooking, a knife in the glove compartment of his car, and a sack full of women's clothing.
Oh my God.
I know.
You visit your boyfriend and you're like, this is weird, but I'm just going to leave it. You know,
I had found a sack full of women's clothing. Remember the hothead I was in my, can you imagine? Like, it wouldn't even be, I think you're killing. It would be like, I'm going to kill you. Like,
oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I wouldn't be dating that person any longer. That's for fucking
absolutely
sure.
Not. Actually, when I read that part and I immediately thought about me, and then I thought about you, and I thought about the letter that you would write that person, because those of you who know Remy knows that she's infamous for writing letters that will burn you to your soul when she's done with you.
I will word murder you if you betray me.
Yeah.
I will word murder you.
And it's, as a person who has never received one of these letters, it's a great joy to me to watch her write them. And then she sometimes will like be like, how does this sound? I'm like, it sounds great. So anyway.
Yeah, she would have been word murdered, but yes.
Word murdered for sure. So she also told them that he was always in debt, and she suspected that he'd stolen most of the things of value that he had. And that when she confronted him about this, he told her that if she told anyone, he would, and I quote, break her fucking neck.
Okay. Yeah. These are
troubling. Yeah. She also told them that when Bundy told her that she was considering cutting her long dark hair that was parted in the middle, as we said, uniformly most of what his victims look like, he became very upset, and that sometimes she woke up to find him studying her body under the covers with a flashlight.
What?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Studying her body?
Yeah. Yeah. She revealed that he kept a lug wrench taped up lug wrench in the trunk of her car, which was also a VW bug.
What is a taped? What does that mean?
So you know what a lug wrench is?
Is it the one from Clue?
Yes.
Yes.
Where you hit. It's the one from Clue.
Okay. If you haven't seen the movie Clue, your life is incomplete. You need to go watch it right now. But yeah, it's like it's one of those big metal, it's all metal wrenches, and they use it.
And one end is pretty solid, and it's like used to like loosen lugs lugs, right?
I don't know.
It's loosening lugs. But, and I know from Michael that you tape it so that your hands, when they get sweaty, don't slip on steel, they slip pretty easily, but on tape they don't. And I'm not sure what you're doing with, I don't know, it's a little weird, like if you're doing something, because I mean honestly, if you're just loosening some lugs, it just doesn't take that long. Like, it shouldn't, most of the time you shouldn't really need to worry about your hands being too sweaty unless you're doing something vigorous.
Yeah, what else are you, doesn't involve lugs, gonna place my money on that.
Yeah. Some bad things. So she's got that. He kept that in the trunk of her car, which is also a VW bug, and that he borrowed her car a lot. And then the police verified that she couldn't give him an alibi for any of the nights that any of the victims had gone missing in the Pacific Northwest. And then just for good measure, they told her about Diane and their brief engagement in 1973.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell her.
You think that, but don't worry. They stayed together. So
okay.
In September of 75.
Sometimes you just brainwash a woman when she's real itty bitty and she just really has a hard time getting over that.
sometimes you got to learn in the hard way. And she did. So in September of 75, Bundy sells his car and the police pounce on that opportunity. They immediately impound it and they take it apart. They find hair that matches three different victims, which they conclude would be, and I quote, a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. They did not know each other. On October 2nd, they put Bundy in a lineup and he is immediately picked out by Carol DeRanche. So he is charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault.
Wait, tell me again, which one was Carol DeRanche?
Carol DeRanche was the one in, where he...
The mall.
Okay. Where he's like, I'm a cop, you know?
Right.
And okay. She was like...
So she's like, that motherfucker right there.
And he showed up. So they said that when he had to come in for the lineup, he showed up, he'd shaved his beard, he'd cut his hair, and he parted his hair to the other side. And you can see the lineup. Like when you look at the lineup, he looks, I, the picture of it, I will send it to you. He just looks, he's like, I'm in a lineup, you know, and he's like standing, staring straight ahead. And all the other dudes are kind of like, all right, I'm just here. I'm just doing my thing. And he's like, this is stressful.
It's not me. It's not me.
It's definitely not me. Except it was. And she kicked him out immediately. So his $15,000 bond is paid by his parents. And after he leaves jail, he spends most of his time at Liz Clepher's house. That's
he's
right.
Like, baby, oh my God, love you.
Yeah. Love you so much. And she was like, you know what? I love you too.
I have no self-esteem. This sounds none whatsoever.
Honestly, straight women need therapy. Most of us do.
All of us.
I was like, yeah, you need therapy. So in February of 1976, he stands trial for Carol DeRanche's kidnapping. He opted for a bench trial due to all the negative publicity surrounding the case. And after a 4-day trial, he is found guilty and sentenced to 1 to 15 years in prison. In a moment of foreshadowing, it's hilarious to me that it's 1 to 15 years.
One?
Okay.
Can you imagine 1 year? Wow. Okay.
Honestly, can you imagine 15?
No.
Like, he was definitely going to do something bad to her. Okay. So in a moment of foreshadowing.
What year is this, by the way?
76.
Totally. Yeah. 76. The '70s. They're like, women don't matter.
Women, we'll just make more.
Women.
So he's found hiding in a prison yard carrying a homemade escape kit with roadmaps, airline schedules, and a social security card. I'd love to know where he got that. But he was thrown in solitary confinement for a little bit. But later that month, he's charged with Karen Campbell's murder in Colorado. And after briefly resisting extradition, he agrees to go. So in June of 1977, he's transported to Aspen for a preliminary hearing where he had decided to serve as his own attorney. And because he's acting as his own attorney, he isn't wearing shackles or handcuffs. Because if you... Okay, I looked into this because I was like, the fuck? This dude is trouble. What are you... But... Okay, so he's acting as his own attorney. And if he showed up in shackles and handcuffs, it would, what's the word? I can't think of the word. It would prejudice him in the mind of the jurors.
Right.
You can't. So as an attorney, he can't. And they were like, and he won't have the freedom to walk around and do what he needs to do. So
they're like, look, here's the thing. We really sympathize with this guy. Poor guy. So we're just really trying to give him
rough out there in these streets.
The best chance he possibly could get. Like, what?
Okay, so the thing about this is the most of the time, the saying is that like the man, cause you can represent yourself if you want to be your own attorney in court, that's a thing.
Sure.
But there is a saying that was like the man who has himself for an attorney has a fool for a client. In this case, it worked out for him. During a break, he asked to visit the courthouse's law library to conduct some research. And while hiding behind a bookcase that shielded him from the guard's view, he jumps out a second floor window, injuring his ankle, but otherwise unhurt. He sheds a layer of clothes to conceal his identity as a prisoner, and he walks away, walking off through the roadblocks that were being set up specifically for him. And then he hiked up into the Aspen Mountains.
Wow.
So he breaks into a mountain cabin to steal food and clothes, as well as a rifle. And then he starts walking towards the town of Crested Butte, but he got lost.
Crested Butte.
Is it Crested Butte? Yeah. I was like, what a great name for a town.
Crested Butte is the name of this episode for sure.
But you have to spell it B-U-T-T then. Oh, and it does say that here. Probably because my computer is just like, you don't know what you're talking about, and changes words on me all the time. And most of the time I have time to go through and check it. But this shit's 17 pages long. I didn't have time.
Okay. But the crested, like, does it have like a crest tattooed on it? A crested butt?
I mean,
what is a crested?
Verbiage wise, what does crested mean? We'll look into it. So he wanders around for a bit. He never manages to find the trails that would have led him to his freedom, but he does manage to elude everyone who's looking for him, which is a lot of people. So at this point, he's exhausted. He has sprained his ankle in his jump. He's sleep deprived. So he steals a car and he drives back into Aspen, where he is pulled over for a traffic violation again. At this point, he's been a fugitive for 6 days. He lost 25 pounds, but he's pretty much the same old narcissistic Ted. So he's put back in jail. He's advised to sit tight and shut up, because the truth is that the case against him was dissolving pretty steadily. It was weak to begin with. They didn't have a lot of physical evidence, and the defense was winning in all the pretrial motions. And a lot of they were trying to keep evidence out, and they were having a lot of success. It was being ruled inadmissible. It's scary to think about, because he could have won in Colorado. And if that had happened, if that had happened, other prosecutors probably would have backed off, because they would have been like, okay, you can't secure a conviction without this kind of evidence. And they didn't have that kind of evidence in the 70s. And he could have served as little as a year and a half, the Durant kidnapping. So this man could have had it all, could have been a contender, but no. If he had managed to get out of his own way, this story could have had many more chapters, but that's not how it went down. So instead, he starts planning a new escape. He gets himself the floor plans for the jail. He had friends, probably mostly his old friend, Carol Boone. Remember her? Yeah, she's back.
So wait. Sorry, T.O. I just want to get clear in my mind. So he escapes from the library where he was his own attorney.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So he gets pulled over for a traffic violation, but they take one look at him and they're like, you're Ted fucking Bundy. You're a piece of shit. You're coming to us.
Yes. That is correct.
And then he's not representing himself.
Yeah.
And he has a legal team, and they are basically like doing well. And he could have just served a year potentially.
Well, the deal is that if he had sat down and shut up, if he had not escaped in the first place, that didn't look good. He possibly could have won the Colorado case. They didn't have a lot of physical evidence. And then he had already been found guilty for Durant, but that would have maybe been he could have gotten a year and a half for that,
because she didn't die.
And we don't care about women.
Right.
So
it don't matter.
Yeah. 1 to 15 years. So he could have served a year, could have served a year and a half, and then he would have been out on the streets.
Okay. But instead,
he starts planning to escape again.
But wait, so when did he get pulled back into jail?
As soon as he was arrested.
Wait, so he's in his car. He's in Crested Butt.
Oh, no, he never made it to Crested Butt. He's in Aspen.
He's in Aspen. He gets pulled over for a traffic violation. Sorry, I want to be clear. He gets pulled over for a traffic violation. They're like, you're coming with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has his own legal team now.
Yeah.
And then he escapes again.
Girl, let me tell you. So he has friends sneak in money. Probably
what friends? Who are these friends?
Carol Boone and his Mormy friends.
God damn it.
Yeah. He has convinced everybody that this is a travesty of justice, that he did not commit the Durant crime, that she's a professional witness, that the cops have snowballed or that they desperately need to blame these crimes on someone. Remember I told you about the dude who would do anything but go to therapy? Like the dude who was
every dude.
That's
not true. There are some dudes at therapy.
This dude, if you've seen the Bundy tapes, you know, he talks about how Ted told him he was like, I could escape this way, and then did it. And he'd never told anybody about it. And then at the end of the Bundy tape, he talks about like, do I think about Ted? No, I've never dealt with it. it's very sad. And I've just shoved it into my colon where I'll get cancer in 10 years. I mean, like, that's essentially what he's saying, you know, like, no, I never dealt with this extreme trauma in my life. You're like, got it. That checks out.
The fact that I didn't tell anyone about Bundy's plan to escape that he disclosed to me and then escaped.
Because that escape resulted in Florida.
Right.
Which we'll get to.
Okay. But right now we're in Aspen.
So we've got friends sneaking in money to the tune of about $500 in cash. He somehow acquired a hacksaw blade, he claims, from inmates, and he lost 35 pounds, which would have been a red flag to me in and of itself. I've been like, what the fuck is that guy doing? So he saws a hole between the steel reinforcing bars and his ceiling. He squeezes through and he takes the fuck off. Wow. He steals a car, which breaks down. So he hitches a ride into Denver, where he catches a flight to Chicago. And that's when the jail discovered that he was missing, which is about 17 hours after his escape.
Jesus. He's already in 17 hours? What the fuck are they doing?
They'd served him dinner and it looked like he was sleeping. He'd stacked books up to look like it was he was just taking a nap. And when they came back, they were like, huh, he hasn't touched his food. So they go to wake him up and he's gone.
Wow.
Yeah. So he takes a train to Ann Arbor, Michigan, steals a car, drives to Atlanta, gets on a bus, and winds up in Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay.
I had to be Florida. So he claims he intended to go straight, and he figured as long as he laid low, he could fly under the radar, you know, in Florida. Like, he's not the weirdest dude in Florida. This is the 1970s. There's no internet. There's no CODIS. Counties in the same state hardly cooperate, much less in different states. So he really thought that he could live in Florida unimpeded for a long time, but that is not what happened. So January 15th, 1978, Bundy sneaks into the Chi Omega sorority house through a back door with a broken lock at about 2:45 in the morning. And he beats Margaret Bowman with a piece of oak firewood as she slept. And then he garroted her with nylon stockings as his, that's sort of his stocking.
Garroted? That, does that mean strangled?
Okay. So a garrot is when you take
garroted. What does that mean?
Yeah. It's so, I think it's where you take a piece of wood or something I wish I could draw you a picture, but it's like, it's a piece of wood with something tied around it. So you use something to tighten.
Wait, we can't hear you.
Sorry.
So, you're like, you know,
can I explain this to you later?
Okay. Everyone just look up garroted right now. And then you'll know what it means. Cause we don't know what it means.
Basically it means he strangled her, but he used a piece of like wood, some hard, it's probably a piece of wood and nylon pantyhose to do it, where he wraps the pantyhose around her neck. And then he uses the piece of wood to tighten it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was a dick. So then he goes into the room of Lisa Levy and he beats her unconscious, strangles her, tore her nipple off.
Jesus and Christ.
Bit so deeply into her buttocks that he left teeth impressions. And then he assaulted her with a bottle. Next, he attacks Kathy Kleiner, breaking her jaw and deeply cutting her shoulder. And then Karen Chandler, she suffered a concussion, a broken jaw. Several of her teeth got knocked out and he crushed her finger. But they both, the last two, survived the attack, probably because a car pulled in next to their sorority and it illuminated their room. So Bundy got spooked and left. And as he's fleeing out the back door, he runs into Nita Neary, who gets a really, not a great look at him, but she gets a look. So he's not satisfied. So he breaks into a basement apartment 8 blocks away and attacks Cheryl Thomas, leaving her with physical injuries that ended her dance career, but she survived. On the bed, police find a semen stain, pantyhose mask, and two hairs similar to Bundy's. On February 8th, Bundy approaches 14-year-old Leslie Parmenter, who happened to be the daughter of Jacksonville, Florida's police department chief of detectives. And he does this by impersonating a firefighter, but he backs off when her big brother shows up. That same afternoon, he drives west to Salt Lake City, where the next morning, 12-year-old Kimberly Leach went missing from her junior high after she was summoned to her homeroom to pick up her purse, and her body is found 7 weeks later near Suwannee State Park. Her remains revealed that she had been raped, then killed by neck lacerations, which I think is code for cutting her throat.
Yeah.
Kimberly Leach is Bundy's last known victim.
I think so that's the one who looked like his.
Oh, she looked 12.
Yeah. And looked like his like stepdaughter. Like,
I've seen the picture. She did.
Yeah.
She also looked like a miniature version of the women that he attacked, you know,
right.
She was a white girl with dark hair parted in the middle.
Yeah.
So by February 12th, Bundy is running out of steam. He can't afford to pay the rent for the room he'd rented, which is near the Florida State University campus, of course. And he's paranoid that the police are closing in on him, which is kind of hilarious because as far as I could tell, they were not. So he steals a car and he leaves Tallahassee, drives west across the Florida panhandle, where he stopped in Pensacola at the Alabama, well, not at, but near the Alabama border after a police officer ran his plates and realized the car was stolen. This man always caught because of some kind of traffic violation. So he's told that he's under arrest. So he kicks the cop's legs out from under him and tries to run. And the cop's like, okay, that's not right. And so he's surprised. He fires two warning shots and then he tackles Bundy. A search of the car reveals 3 sets of IDs belonging to female FSU students, 21 stolen credit cards, and a stolen TV, as well as the disguise that Bundy used to impersonate a firefighter when he attempted to kidnap Leslie Parmenter. So initially he refuses to disclose his identity, and he's basically, you know, they're like, well, we'll try and process him as a John Doe, but they won't give him bail because they don't know who the fuck he is. Eventually, however, he admits who he is, and he is immediately the prime suspect for the Chi Omega murders.
Why doesn't he just give a fake name?
He did, but the guy whose fake name he gave, they looked into him and he called him up and he was like, yeah, I'm right here. So that's not
actually,
me.
Actually,
I'm something or the other. Keith Meisner, I think, was the name. Mm-hmm. He had an ID that said Keith Meisner, and Keith Meisner was like, nope.
It's like, actually, I'm Keith Meisner.
I'm Keith Meisner, me. So he's charged with the murders of Lisa Levy and Margaret Broman in June of 1979. It's a national event covered by 250 reporters from all around the globe. It's the first trial to be televised nationally in the U.S. He has 5 court-appointed attorneys, but narcissist got a narcissist. And he pretty much insists on handling his defense on his own, which was incredibly stupid. Before the trial event even gets started, a plea bargain had been negotiated that would have given Bundy a 75-year sentence in exchange for his admission to killing Levy and Margaret Bowman, which Bundy originally supported. He figured that in this way, he's safe from the death penalty. And it was a strategic move because he thinks he's going to enter this plea, then wait for the evidence against him to degenerate or get lost, which is a possibility, for witnesses to become unavailable or pass. And then he just straight up retracted he would wait for... Oh yeah, he thought that there was a possibility witnesses were going to retract their testimony. Honestly, I don't know.
Why did he think that?
I think he figured it was traumatic and that maybe they wouldn't want to deal with it.
So he's thinking people are probably not going to want to
relive the worst days of their life. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And he figured that once all that happened, he could file a post-conviction motion to set aside the plea and go to trial and be acquitted. But he couldn't go through with it because he wouldn't get up and say he was guilty. So the jig is pretty well up at this point. He was seen at the Chi Omega house by sorority member Connie Hastings, who identified him as being in the area, and Nita Neary, who saw him fleeing the scene with a bloody oak branch that acted as the murder weapon. Additionally, the forensics team had taken impressions and images of the bite marks that were left on Lisa Levy's body, which a forensic odontologist, that's just a dentist, I'm pretty sure, confirmed matched the fairly distinctive pattern of Bundy's teeth. There was a lot of back and forth about this. So, but they accepted it into evidence. So the jury deliberated less than 7 hours before convicting him of first degree murder and 2 counts of burglary. The judge imposed the death penalty. And 6 months later, he's also convicted of the murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach, mostly due to an eyewitness who apparently saw him leading her from the schoolyard to his stolen van. Not sure why they do something about that, but okay. So during the penalty phase of this trial, yeah, I know, the fucking 70s. Oh, look at that dude taking that 12-year-old away from school during school time. Anyway.
Into a rape van. No big deal.
No big deal.
Anyway, algebra,
right? Got to finish my fucking sandwich here. So during the penalty phase of this trial, Bundy used an obscure law that allows a legal marriage to occur if it's declared in court in the presence of a judge to marry Carol Boone. This is on tape if you want to look it up. It's like, you're just like, this is a circus. Carol Boone, whose pressing need for therapy continued well into the 1980s because she stayed married to this dude for like, I think, 6 years. So in February of 1980, he's sentenced to death for the murder of Kimberly Leach. And after that's pronounced, he stands up and he says, tell the jury they were wrong, which is a weird way to convince people you're sane and competent. So Bundy spent the next 9 years appealing his convictions. And while doing so, he initiated a series of interviews with Stephen Mycod, Michou, I think is how it's pronounced, and Hugh Ainsworth. They kept trying to get him to discuss his crimes, but he had admitted guilt at this point. And he's pretty evasive and they're getting frustrated. So they came up with this idea to ask him. They were like, we're going to treat you like an expert witness. And why don't you just tell us what you think this person was thinking about? So he talks about all the crimes in the third person.
And yeah, it's genius because we're like, they just play into
you're so smart.
Narcissist. Yeah. They're like,
you're so smart.
You would know.
You know about this, right?
You're just a genius and a psych major when you dropped out of college.
Yeah. So that really, well, I think he got his psych degree. He graduated. He didn't get his law degree, but he got a psych degree, which is
terrifying. First of all, I know a million people who dropped out of college who are 8,000 times more adept than this fucking moron.
Honestly, part of me is like, no, I get it. He was like, people, they're weird. Let me try and understand it. So, you know, he got a psych degree, but unfortunately he used that power for evil. So that really opens things up for him. And he discussed his crimes at length and in detail, including the psychological motivations and urges that might be behind these crimes. He also confirmed the accusations made by his ex-girlfriend, Liz Klepfer, that he was a proliferate thief. And eventually he admitted that his desire to fully possess these women had a lot to do with his crimes, in addition to the practical need to get rid of evidence, you know, which is why he killed a lot of them so that they couldn't say that what he did to them. But the idea of possessing these women completely, including their remains, that's why, you know, instead of leaving them out where they could be found or returned to their families for burial or whatever, he generally hid them. And then for days and often weeks afterwards, he would revisit them. He was a necrophiliac. But he also did weird shit. Remember, like, he washed their hair and he put makeup on them. He described washing one victim's hair until her scalp came off.
Oh my God. Wait. So but he's talking about all of this in the third person. He's yes. saying, this is what I think this person did.
Yes. The scalp came off thing, that was actually when he's talking about it, but that was later. Yeah.
Okay.
So in later interviews with FBI profiler Bill Hagmeier, he described the, quote, deep mystical satisfaction he took in killing. And he designated the grounds on which he'd committed these crimes as sacred ground that he would constantly be called back to. He also told Hagmeier that he considered himself an amateur in his early years and that he'd reached his prime predator phase around 74, which is when we knew, like, that's 74 is the first murder we know about. So most right. likely he was killing for years before wow. he popped up on law enforcement's radar. His wife, Carol Ann, supported him through all of this. She brought him money and drugs in through her vag. She openly advocated for him. She told anyone and everyone that he was innocent. She moved to Florida to be closer to him. And it was as close as a normal marriage as someone in jail could have. In fact, with the help of some fairly lax guards, she became pregnant and then gave birth to Bundy's only known child, Rose Bundy, who was born on October 24th, 1982. In 1986, he was scheduled to be killed in Florida's electric chair. And after the date was set for July 2nd, Bundy began to confess to Hagmeier in earnest, revealing the degradations he visited on his victims' bodies, including the necrophilia, admitting in some cases he performed it until putrefaction forced him to discontinue.
What does that mean? You mean this means they had decomposed to such a point that he no longer could do it.
Oh my Jesus,
God.
Yeah. Bundy explained that he decapitated about 12 of his victims with a hacksaw and that he kept a group of the heads in his apartment for a while before being forced to dispose of them. Less than 15 hours before his execution was scheduled, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals stayed his execution indefinitely and remanded the Chi Omega case for review on technicalities, including Bundy's mental competency. So those technicalities were actually never resolved, interestingly enough. But a new date was set for November of 1986, which was also stayed, but the appeals court. But then in December, the Supreme Court was like, nah, and they refused to review the ruling. And they set a new and final execution date of January 24th, 1989. This is, for the record, pretty quick for a death sentence. Most of the time, death sentences can take between 20 and 30 years to run through the appeals. So people are furious that it took as long as it did. But it's important to remember that this process was actually fairly expedited and that Bundy's lawyers are not using shenanigans to delay this. So once he realized that there were no more opportunities for escape, he agreed to speak openly about his crimes with investigators, no more third-party stuff. He confessed to all eight Washington and Oregon murders. Then he described more victims that no one even knew about. And he admitted to burning the head of Donna Manson, one of his earlier victims, in Liz Klopfer's fireplace.
Oh my God.
He admitted to murders in Idaho, Utah, and California. And eventually it became clear that he was hoping to tantalize his investigators with this information without giving everything up in the hope that they would advocate for him to have his execution delayed or halted.
So they could get more info out of him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he would talk about these victims, but he wouldn't disclose where the remains were. And that ended up backfiring on him in a major way because the authorities were so incensed at the scope and magnitude of his crimes that it just stiffened their resolve to get this execution done. His attorney, Diane Weiner, I don't know.
Let's go with Weiner.
Let's go with Weiner.
It's not great either way.
Yeah. He had an unrequited crush on, lobbied hard to get the governor to grant clemency, but it just wasn't going to happen. So he was beginning to be defined in like these infamous dimensions with which we think of him now. And the powers that be, as well as the victims, families, and friends, just wanted him gone. As Governor Bob Martinez said, for Bundy to be negotiating for his life over the bodies of his victims is despicable.
Ugh.
By this time, he's been abandoned by just about everyone except his mother. Carol Ann, who had evidently been a true believer in his innocence, is shocked and humiliated when Bundy admitted to the murders, and she divorced him in 86. She moved and she took their daughter and her son with her. She reportedly felt very betrayed by his admissions, and she was deeply hurt about, I guess, was his not subtle crush on Diane Weiner. So when he called her on the eve of his execution as one of his two phone calls, she did not answer. So he never said goodbye to her or his daughter. Mm-hmm. He was executed via the electric chair at 7:16 a.m. on January 24th, 1989, while a throng of spectators basically had what amounted to a tailgate outside the prison. His remains were cremated, and at his request, the ashes were scattered at an undisclosed location in the Cascade Range of Washington State, which is where some of his victims were found. So, yeah.
I don't like that decision.
I don't like that either.
What? You're going to scatter? So now they fucking... Talk about not resting in peace.
But the truth is that we don't know where all of his victims are. Ashes. So anywhere. Yeah. I mean, he could have asked to be put someplace that, you know, we were like, okay, that seems safe, but we don't know.
Safe. Toilet. Flush. Goodbye. You're a piece of shit. You deserve no respect, no love. Get the fuck out of, get out of this dimension.
It was interesting. They looked at his mental competency and they discovered that he was a manic depressive. And I don't know. I mean, okay, sure. I know a few of those.
I mean, who isn't? You know?
Right. But they didn't do, like, I was like, but was he a sociopath? Like, he was a sociopath, right? Like, I mean, and they, I don't,
he was a psychopath.
I don't know that they ever did the testing to like figure, I don't know if they were just like, we don't fucking care. We don't fucking yeah. care. I mean, there's lots of evidence that he talked about how he didn't feel things, how he couldn't love, how he just didn't feel remorse or pity or sympathy or any of that.
That also is narcissism. They can't, well, yeah, narcissists, they can't, I guess it depends. If you're a malignant narcissist, then like you just can't feel.
Yeah. It's bad.
The other thing I was going to say is that, Carol, that was
yeah, wait. Carol Ann.
Who he married.
Yeah.
I also remember from the doc that someone saying, like a sister or a close friend saying that when she, I must have been a friend, when she was young,
her brother died.
She was supposed to be watching her brother and he drowned in a pool.
But also her brother was 15. And I was like, why? I
mean, but apparently what this friend said in the doc was that she carried this deep guilt.
Yeah.
Went through her life looking for people to save.
To rehabilitate. I saw that too.
And I mean, that's a tragic thing. It's just fucking tragic.
No, everything about this, the way he affected women was tragic in every respect. There was, yeah. I mean, his poor mother, did you see the part where they were talking about, I don't remember which one that was in, but they were talking about how his poor mom, like they played the tapes for her. Like, this is him confessing to these crimes. And she made like little yelping noises, just like, oh, oh. And then as soon as it was done, they asked if she had any questions and she said no. And then she was like, who wants apple pie and ice cream? And they had apple pie and ice cream.
Oh God. How could you eat after that? My God. Also, that just kind of harkens back to what I originally was talking about, is that when you, we live in a culture that for so many years took the primal, that primal nature out of women. And part of a primal nature is an ability to say, fuck off. That is yeah. part of your, it's natural to be able to do that. But women have been so stripped of that power over so many years. And what you have in the end is women like that. Women like Liz, what the fuck her name? What's her name?
Klopfer.
Klopfer.
She changed her name. So now it's Elizabeth Kendall.
Okay. And his mother, who are just like, I don't know how to connect with that primal energy anymore. All I know how to do is ice cream and apple pie.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, I mean, it's so heartbreaking because how many of those women who died had a weird feeling before they went with him? But
I would imagine everyone who survived said they did.
Yeah.
Everyone who survived was like, ooh,
I had a weird vibe, but I ignored it because I didn't want to be rude. I didn't want to. And I've felt that. You've felt
that.
We've all felt that. And it's heartbreaking. It's awful. The result that it's had, it's just, and it's this, it's like this unseen death, right? This death of the primal energy of women. We don't see it. We don't talk about it. I mean, we do, some of us, but
we're starting to talk about it now, but culturally,
it's not a conversation, you know,
and I would say even now it's not encouraged for the most part.
And then you have Trump with his nasty, she's a nasty woman.
Grabbing by the pussy. Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. That whole thing where it's like,
and then those poor women walking around with the shirts that were say, I'd let Trump grab my pussy. Where you're like, it's lady.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you jumped into that primal shit, but you went
the wrong way, honey. That's the wrong end of the pool, my dear.
Also, I do want to be very clear and say, because I feel like I said something that could be misconstrued. I don't give a fuck who's graduated high school, college, who went to college, who dropped out of college. I don't think that in any way is representative of someone's intelligence level.
Oh, absolutely not.
I'm just looking for ways to talk shit about Bundy at any at all moments.
Well, I think the thing is that Bundy styled himself as this very intellectual, very Republican, very buttoned down, very like member of the educated, smart upper crust, better than you, better than everybody. And the dude's LSAT's words were trash.
Right.
And I'm like, you're not as great as you think you are. And like,
you're just a narcissist.
If you had been like, oh, I'm not going to be a great lawyer, but I would have made great pottery. What, you know,
great.
Fine. Great. Yeah. But I'm not a great lawyer, so I'm going to start cutting women up in half. Like, nah, like, no, that's actually not an acceptable alternative.
Yeah. Well, so let's get into the astrology.
Oh, I can't wait.
Okay. Okay. So here's the thing about Bundy's astrology. It's super fucking interesting, but it's not fancy. It's not complicated, which I was sort of surprised by, but it's just like the fundamentals of serial killer astrology. Like if I were going to teach serial killer astrology 101, I would use this chart.
That actually makes sense.
Yes. I think it's so interesting because it makes me think that like all the complexity we saw in the Menendez charts, in Kurt Cobain's chart, in OJ Simpson's chart, I feel like all of that was because there was deep emotion involved. But with Bundy,
they aren't serial killers. Those were passion-based killings.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. And with Bundy, he was truly a stripped down, cold-blooded rape and murder machine. Like
we should do at some point, I'm sure we will, another serial killer and see like when that's what they do.
Wait, but I do have to tell you, I looked up Dahmer's chart.
I'm not sure you can compare Dahmer.
No.
He ate people.
And and his chart was fucking insane. Fucking out of like, I was like, oh my God. It would take him like 2 hours to go through his chart. It's wild. But this chart is like, it's like, I don't know.
It's the vanilla ice cream of killer like charts.
Scandinavian interior design of serial killer IKEA astrology.
Like, you know, like that kind of like when you look at him, the reason I think he was successful as he was at killing, which is a weird thing to say, but because of the way he looked and acted and the Republicanism, I'm going to say it again, don't fuck Republicans, but like, this is why he got away with it. Like imagine if this man had been black.
Oh yeah.
He'd have gotten two in and they'd have been like that one right there, officer. You know what I mean?
They would have just like lined up a whole bunch of black men and just like executed all of them and been like, one of them's probably it.
Oh, one moment. My microphone went off for a second.
Oh, you're back. You're good.
I'm back. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. The fucking cat pulled at the cord.
God damn it, Clover. You.
But God damn it.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I honestly, I just feel like so much of people are like, oh, he was this amazing genius. And I'm like, was he? Because he gave them his real fucking name. And like, hey, here's a thought. I'm Fred, you know?
Yeah. Any fucking buddy
else. Any other name. And the man got caught doing it. I mean, it was traffic violation. Like every single time the man got caught, it was in a car. Like, what is going on?
Also, I'm sorry. Jumping out a window is not genius. It's just like... It's like any fucking monkey can be like,
I'm just gonna jump out the window. Lucky too. I mean, if he'd broken both legs, this would be an entirely different story.
Right. Just totally.
Genetically speaking, he came out with white skin, blue eyes, wavy hair, a decent build, and apparently good shocks. Like, I don't know what else to tell you. That had a lot to do with why this man was successful as he was. Was he depraved? Absolutely. No doubt about that. But a lot of dudes are. You know, I'm just going to say it. So
okay. So let's look at his chart because it actually is really fascinating. It's really fascinating. So as we know, Bundy was a Sag like moi,
but
I'll tell you, he was a November Sag, November 24th.
I love how you're trying to differentiate here.
No, it's, and this is true. Uh-huh. This is true that November Sagges, and this is a thing that November Sagges are known for being a little different from December Sagges, which isn't a good or bad thing. But November Sagges, and they get a lot more influence from Scorpio, and you can often feel that in their energy, either because
that more, checks out
more, yeah, more serious, more focused. They're quieter generally than December Sagges, and that's going to be more true the closer you are to Scorpio. So the Scorpio cutoff is the 21st. He's the 24th. So, you know, he's in that, he's in that border town.
He got his foot in there. Yeah.
He's in that border town. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it also checks out because Sagittarians love learning. They love being in school. And as a sign, one of its expertise, like areas of expertise, is law and philosophy. And as we know, he was studying to become a lawyer. So hold that thought for a minute. We'll come back to that. But the first red flag I see in his chart is a stellium in Scorpio, which, by the way, I also have a stellium in Scorpio.
I was going to say that sounds real familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. I was. So, you know, if you have
a word murder, we've been over that.
See, there you go.
Yeah.
Worder.
Worder.
You commit worder. Okay. So yeah, so, but let's look at this fucking stellium. Okay. And first of all, a stellium, if for people who forgot, is when there are, when there are a bunch of planets in one sign or house or both in my case, because I use whole house system. So it's three or more. So he has a Scorpio stellium in the fourth house, which is the house of home and family, which tells me, and I'll get more into this, but that right off the bat, I'm thinking there's probably something sordid going on in his childhood since we're dealing with Scorpio. I would not be surprised if there was, and we're dealing with Scorpio in the fourth house. I would think it's some kind of sexual trauma, power struggle issues, or like a deep rage type stuff. And you kind of mentioned his dad. And also this theory that
his grad father.
Yeah. That his grandfather was also his father.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't
know Alabama shit.
Yeah. We don't know that, but there was definitely something going on because we're in the fourth house. Something wasn't right with the family. And I would say it probably goes pretty far back in his family since we're in the fourth house. Because to review, every sign has a positive side and a shadow side. Scorpio in its shadow is dealing with death, both figurative and literal, sexual abuse, manipulation, addiction, obsession, seething rage, jealousy, and trauma.
So on the lighter end of the spectrum is what you're saying.
Yeah. So, and then get this. So let's look at this actual stellium. What planets and placements are we working with? We've got Chiron. We've got Chiron in Scorpio. God.
Yeah. Oh no.
So Chiron, better known in astrology as the wounded healer, who I like to call the wounded wounder, but we'll get to that. And then we've got Jupiter in there, Venus, and Mercury. First of all, I'm just going to say it. If you're looking
in Scorpio.
Yes. Well, you and I both have Venus.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay.
Well, I've thought about killing people. Yeah, but and I've said this before, this is key. I haven't done it yet.
Okay. If you're looking at a man's chart and you see Chiron in Scorpio, maybe just don't
run. You know,
maybe not that guy.
Time to run.
You feel me? Maybe you just fucking Nick Miller moonwalk right on out of there. Tell him you're going to get some lingerie out of your car. Never come back. Because Chiron, let's review Chiron. Chiron is called the wounded healer. Chiron shows you where your deepest wound lies in this lifetime, and also where you have the most potential to either help others heal by teaching them how you've found healing for your wound, or to fuck other people up. Because if you don't heal your Chiron wound, you're just operating out of it. You're coming from a wounded place that you're probably not even conscious of. And so you're going to hurt people, because hurt people hurt people, especially hurt people who aren't in therapy. Scorpio, as we sort of discussed already, is one of the most emotionally intense signs. And in its shadow, it's one of the signs most capable of the dark shit because, among other reasons, it oversees death, power struggles, jealousy, blah, 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 seething rage, all the things. So when you have Chiron and Scorpio, you're going to have a wound around control and wanting to be in control, around sexuality and sexual abuse, around rage, deep-seated jealousy, obsession, addiction, compulsion. So that's number one in this chart of doom. And that is also my PSA to everyone. Check his fucking chart. If he has Chiron and Scorpio, you know.
Yeah, unless he's like one of those dudes where you're like, okay, you've done the work. But if he's under 30, he hasn't.
But you need to know he's done. You need receipts.
You need to be real sure.
You need receipts for that, honey. Don't just take his word for it with Chiron and Scorpio. No,
group therapy sessions. Yeah, you want to be in there.
Yeah. And yeah. And like, we're sad for him. We're sad for his Chiron and Scorpio, but we don't date him. You know?
No. We can be sad in the, in the background. Like,
yeah, exactly.
In
the motherfucking periphery. Okay.
Right.
Then we have Jupiter in Scorp. Jupiter is the classic bloom where you plant it. No matter where you put Jupiter, it's going to make that thing bigger and stronger and more abundant. So when you have Jupiter in Scorpio, it's all about making that Scorpio energy bigger. Like, so instead of killing, three or four people,
we're just going to maximize.
Yeah. Maximize. Then we have Venus and Mercury in Scorpio, and they're conjunct. Let's just pause here. I too, as we mentioned, have Venus and Mercury in Scorpio, and I also have a Scorpio stellium. So don't freak out if you have those things, unless you have Chiron in Scorpio, in which case, baby, you better
freak
just
the fuck out.
Hightail it on over to therapy and take care of that shit. Okay. Here's the fucked thing. Mercury conjunct Venus is a really nice conjunction. Mercury oversees communication. Venus oversees beauty, love, art. So when they get together, it makes people charming and social. It makes them communicate in ways that feel loving and sweet and charismatic and refined. And as we know, that's exactly how Bundy came across. So this is one of those instances when a really nice astrological aspect is actually super fucked when you put it into context with the rest of the chart.
Yeah, it's using your powers for evil.
Right. So let's talk about Venus conjunct Mercury in Scorpio. Venus in Scorpio is super intense and actually is considered to be in its detriment, meaning this is one of the worst signs for Venus to be in.
Jesus.
So if you don't mind, I'll just be sobbing.
I'm just going to go cry in this corner over here.
But yeah, that's actually true. And like, it's considered to be a fact in like traditional astrology that it's not a great placement for Venus, because Venus is all about affection and sweetness. And Scorpio is about control and rage and jealousy and obsession.
Yeah, that sounds like a rough.
Yeah, match. It's not great. It's not great. One thing I'll say is that Venus also plays a hand in sexuality. So people with this placement care a lot about sex. And actually, this can be super like hot and passionate placement for sex, if I don't say so myself.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, if they have Chiron.
But don't say that because you're my little sister, so stop it.
Yeah. Well, I've never had sex, so I guess
Absolutely.
We'll find out one day.
Me neither, despite my two children.
But if a person also has Chiron up in there too, you probably aren't going to like the kind of sex you get from this person.
AKA the kind of sex that starts with rape and ends with murder, for example. Yeah. So Venus in Scorpio means, if we're talking about the shadow side of Scorpio, it means we're talking about jealousy, control issues, all the things, death, okay, figurative or literal, and or in relationship to women and femme folks. All of this stuff that all of this dark shit applied to women and femme folks, because Venus oversees the feminine. So death in relationship to women, that's Venus in Scorpio with a side of Chiron in Scorpio. And potentially, right? Okay, so we're putting the pieces together. And this Chiron in Scorpio is a really big piece of this. So like, if you have Venus in Scorpio, but you don't have Chiron in Scorpio, you're really looking at a whole different thing. And then Mercury in Scorpio makes you super obsessive. Mercury oversees both how you communicate and how you think. So now we have obsessive, compulsive Mercury conjunct Venus. So this is going to add an additional layer of obsession to his dark relationship to women. So this is just like fixation station, baby, with women and sex. I also want to add this piece in because I think it's interesting. Some astrologers think of the fourth house, the house of home, as a house that actually refers more to a person's interior landscape. The idea being that you are your forever home, you and everything going on inside you. So that's an interesting take when we're looking at these elements that are so fundamental to him. But even if you were looking at all of this through a more conventional astrological lens, I would say that something happened in his childhood, something that originated in his family, like a trauma that goes back in his family line. Some people think of the fourth house as the house of ancestors.
Well, I mean, we do know that both of his grandparents, who raised him until he was three and told him that they were his parents, were mentally ill.
Right.
And his grandfather, at least, was at minimum very abusive.
And with Chiron there, I would say also that there's a sexual aspect. I would think that there's like a sexual abuse aspect.
Did you ever see his mom in any interviews?
No.
Okay. So,
apple pie and ice cream.
Apple pie. So I'm not going to say any names, but you'll know there's a person in our family who, is heavily medicated and denies reality. And it reminds me of that person. That's just like, everything's fine.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And, I remember I watched a lot of her and I went back and then I looked up a lot of her just to look at videos of her. And I was like, okay, like that, it screams to me childhood sexual abuse.
Yep.
Because there's just something about her that's just like, that's done and I will never look at it again.
Right.
You know,
like I can't deal with reality.
Yeah.
It was so terrible. I can't think about it. I'm on drugs. I'm on lithium.
But what's amazing is that she almost had it. You know, I mean, she had her four kids. She had a good husband. She had a life, you know, like she had kind of done it, but
Bundy's mom, you mean?
But Bundy's mom is still Bundy's mom. And he was like, nope, sorry, we're not done with this yet.
Yeah. You can't just like, well, and that was, I think another thing about the 50s is it was so brainwashy and like white picket fence. No one could actually deal with what was going on emotionally. Everything was swept under the rug.
Well, they were all on drugs. I mean, they were like, it's, you know, if you do any kind of studying about it, the women, I don't know about the men, they were all drunk most of the time. I mean, you could start drinking at 10 a.m. and that was actually totally fine. But the women were all on massive amounts of drugs. And I watched this whole documentary about how in the 80s, how they started pulling women off of all of the diet pills they didn't call them diet pills, but like, you know, all of the uppers that they'd been on for years. And all of a sudden, everybody gained a bunch of weight.
And got really sad.
Well, yeah. And that's when they created antidepressants, but like
got depressed.
That's when like Jenny Craig and all that shit started to get big because they yanked women off of all of these pills because they were like, oh, now they're in the workforce and they're getting too aggressive. Like, you know, they're like, we don't mind if you like mop aggressively, but if you're going to be in the boardroom yelling at me, I'm taking you off your meds, you know? And like, yeah. And that's how the whole like diet shit became big, is because women went from being like a size 2 to 6 to like a size 14 in a matter of a few months because they took them off their fucking meds.
American history.
it's good stuff and it's different for women. And that is the more, you know,
the more
rainbow
you
star
know.
At the end. Like, it's true. There's a different history for women out there than there is for dudes in our country, probably every country, but I'm not going to speak with authority about anywhere else or really about here, but,
or really about anything.
Let's really about anything is the God's honest truth. I don't know what's happening 90% of the time.
Oh man. Okay.
I'm just here.
So then he has a stellium in Sag as well, right next door in the fifth house. Okay. So we were in the fourth, we're moving to the fifth. We're now in Sag. We've got the sun, the south node, the moon and Mars. And sorry, the Mars comes first, then the moon and then Lilith. Okay. Having a sun in the fifth house, we talked about this with Jim Jones, I think, is a common placement for actors. The fifth house is about, among other things, make believe. So when your identity and ego is in the fifth house, you're particularly good at playing make believe, aka conning people, and coming off in a way that's totally not who you are, right? You're just playing make believe. Okay. So his sun and south node are conjunct, and his moon and Lilith are conjunct. His moon, Mars, and Lilith are conjunct. A conjunction, to review, is when two planets or astrological placements are right on top of each other or right next to each other in a chart. It's so interesting that we talked about the south node so much in Lizzie Borden's chart, and now we're seeing it so prominently again here. So let's briefly review for those of you who haven't listened to the Lizzie Borden episode. In astrology, there's something called the nodes of destiny. These are two nodes that are always 180 degrees apart from each other. They're related to the moon and the moon's orbit, in case anyone's curious about what they like actually are. So you have the north node, which represents everything you're supposed to be creating more of in this life. The south node represents your past lives, your past karma, your past lessons, places where you think maybe you have opportunity, but actually you don't, because the real opportunity is in your north node. And also, yeah, it's like
psych.
Yeah. Honestly,
fuck, and also life is hard.
Well, and for some people it's harder than others when I look at these charts. And also it's just like bad fucking luck. So basically your south node is like, this is not good. This is where not to go, which is good information to have. You know, this is what's not going to work for you anymore in this life. And Ted Bundy has his sun conjunct his south node. For one thing, this is going to tie his ego, the sun, to behaviors that he should be staying the fuck away from, that are going in the opposite direction of the direction he should be going. But also in general, if you see this in a chart, you're probably looking at someone who has low self-esteem or who feels insecure, which I think he really did. But let's TO. Remember
he definitely did. Remember he talked about how when he was devastated when he discovered that everybody in law school was smarter than him?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And also like the whole over the top revenge thing with his ex, you only do that if you feel shitty about yourself, you know?
It's true.
Like,
it's true.
Okay, but let's TO. Remember how he's studying to become a lawyer and law is associated with Sagittarius in part?
Yes.
That's a really clear example of how he was leaning into the direction he was overtly not supposed to go toward. With South Node in Sag, you're supposed to be letting go of Sag stuff, aka becoming a lawyer. That's what you've already done in past lives. And now you're supposed to move on. But with his son there, it's like his whole identity is holding on to the one section of his chart he's supposed to move away from in this life. And it's fucking creating problems. Another interesting thing about that I read, and I don't know how much weight to put into this necessarily, but I see where this interpretation is coming from. And I think it's fascinating. And that is that the sun conjunct south node indicates someone who was royalty in past life. So they probably were used to being treated like royalty, being able to do whatever they wanted. And so they struggle in this life with the idea that they can't take or have any and everything whenever they want it. And of course, this wasn't written, you know, in relationship to Ted Bundy. It was just something that I found when I was researching South Node conjunct the sun. And so I just think it's really fucking interesting, man, you know, to quote the dude.
Yeah. Yikes.
So, yikes. Yeah.
Because it turns out what he wanted was like dead female bodies.
Well, and also like he was like, everything was a violation of someone else, but it was like, I can, I do what I want. I take what I want, you know?
Right.
So that conjunction is going on, right? Sun conjunct south node. Boots scoot on over just a little bit. And you have another conjunction in Sagittarius. This one is Mars conjunct the moon, conjunct Lilith. Holy fucking moly. This one is major. So to review, Mars in its shadow, like the Roman god, is the planet of war and violence. You know, Mars will cut a bitch. And so let's talk for a second about the difference between Pluto and Mars, since they're both related in their shadow to rage and violence. Pluto will sit on feelings for years and feel intense hatred and obsess on their resentment and plot to murder someone in the most painful, torturous revenge scenario.
Okay.
Essentially what you saw him do with his ex-girlfriend, for example, that's like a Pluto thing, right? Like I'm going to jump through all these weird hoops and I have this whole elaborate plan to make you feel like shit, right?
Mars, as opposed to just murdering her.
Like, or as opposed to just like fucking yelling at her and being like, I'm mad at you. Fuck you. I hate you. And then moving on with your life. Right. Cause that's more of Mars energy. Mars anger is quick tempered. It's like being blinded by fury, punching someone in the face and then being like, okay, we're cool now. Right. Because I'm over it.
Because I didn't find, I mean, not that I was looking, but I didn't find any proof that he did anything like that. He didn't seem to have, I mean, the irony of me saying this is violent outbursts like that were, you know, I mean, like everybody has a moment where they lose their shit. And the most I could find was like one time Liz Klepfer confronted him and he was like, you know, I'll break your fucking neck. But he didn't yell.
No, it's not even. Oh, he doesn't necessarily have to yell. We're going to get wait till I go through this and then tell me what you think.
Okay.
So we're working with a blind rage that kind of takes over and then is gone. Okay. That's Mars here in Sagittarius, which by the way, Sag is a fire sign. So it really lends itself to that energy of popping up quick and then being gone. Then we have the moon. So the moon, people probably already know, represents your emotions, your internal landscape. When you have Mars sitting on top of someone's moon, now you have rage guiding someone's emotions, right?
What's his moon sign again?
Sag. All of this is in Sag.
Oh.
Okay. So why do you say that? Sag.
I don't know. I'm an Aries. I don't know why. But
you, yeah, and
that's rough too.
You have moon in Aries, girl.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I have moon in Aries and that's, yeah. It's no better. It might be worse.
No, it is definitely worse.
Okay. Well, I wasn't going to say that, but okay.
No, moon in Aries is like basically having, it's very similar to what I'm talking about, but whatever, you're fine. So
no, I'm not.
So anyway, because we're talking about the moon and we're talking about emotions, this person is going to feel really strongly about this rage, this Mars moon conjunction. So we're talking about emotional, violent rage, sort of blackouts. I'm using the word blackout because I'm trying to think of a way to describe like it coming on strong.
Well, like episodes.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. That's moon conjunct Mars. But then we also have Lilith over here. Lilith, people maybe don't know, but we've talked about it a lot. We've talked about it in Courtney Love's chart, also Lizzie Borden's chart. Lilith is the dark side of the moon. So the dark aspects of the moon. It's associated with Lilith in the Bible, who wanted to mount Adam and ride the fuck out of him because it's better that way. But Adam was fucking lame and bad in bed and was like, no, God hates when we do sex the right way. I refuse. So Lilith was like, you're a prude. Eden sucks. I'm out. And so she's been cast as the evil version of Eve, but lol, she's obviously the best and she's my favorite. Anyway, astrology, which if you hadn't noticed, is rooted in archetypes, uses the archetype of biblical Lilith to understand this point in people's charts where they harbor rebellious, feminine, emotional energy. So I'm always curious about Lilith and women's charts because it essentially gives information about how women relate to the fact that they live in a patriarchy. Obviously, it was a key player in Courtney Love's chart. It was a huge player in Lizzie Borden's chart because when you're looking at women who are full of rage and acting out against men in various ways, you're looking at Lilith. However, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about how men relate to Lilith, but with Bundy, I was particularly curious. Bundy, in my mind, you know, he was raping a lot of young, liberated women. And this was going on during a time, and this is something they talk about Falling for a Killer. When feminism and women's lib was entering the playing field full force, like shit is changing. Women aren't like obeying their fathers and husbands in the same way they did in the 50s and even in the 60s. And it was reflected all around, you know, women getting jobs, going to college, wearing short skirts, sleeping with whoever they wanted. All of that is new. And it coincided with this massive uptick in serial killers raping and murdering women because these men hated seeing women become empowered. It was very threatening to their egos and that need to control. So we have Bundy's violent emotional rage moon directly tied into Lilith, the part of the feminine that is rebellious and empowered and is not here to kowtow to men and to the patriarchy. So I'm looking at this chart, right, to your point. And I was like, there's something missing because we're in Sagittarius. And Sag can have wanderlust, right? Like a desire to know more and more. That's very much a Sagittarius thing. And to always want to explore. And I can understand how that sort of like insatiable desire to go further and further could make him fixate on these liberated women. But to take that drive, that need to see more and more, and to bring that level of depravity and that level of macabre that he did, I just don't see that with Sagittarius. With even with this conjunction that's really strong, I just don't see it. So I'm staring at this chart and I'm like, what am I missing? And that's when I realized Pluto is exactly trine his moon, which means it's also trine his Mars and it's also trine Lilith. Even though it's not an exact trine to those two, it's still considered a trine. But
Pluto's
it's
the planet that makes everything bigger.
No, that's Jupiter. Pluto that's Jupiter. Oversees Scorpio.
Oh
yeah, girl. Oh. Pluto embodies all of Scorpio energy. And now Pluto is talking to Mars, talking to the moon, talking to Lilith. And that makes a lot of fucking sense. So let's talk about it. All of that Scorpio energy is concentrated in this one tiny ice planet in the sky, this planet of evil, potentially. And also some other good shit. If you have a different chart or you go to therapy and get help with your demons, whatever, but potentially just fucking evil. The other thing is Mars isn't manipulative, right? Mars wears its anger or its bravery in its, you know, shadow or light side on its sleeve. It's much more transparent. Pluto is the manipulator. Pluto is the one who dresses up like a fucking mall cop and gets a woman to think that she should get in his car with him. And Pluto wants control. This is all Scorpio energy. It obsesses over control and it is ruthless in its drive to get and keep control. And with this trine reaching out to Lilith, Pluto's going to want to control those liberated, empowered, college attending, miniskirt wearing women. And it will stop at nothing to do it. It is relentless and it is cutthroat. Pardon the pun. Sorry. Mm. So how does Pluto want to control? Well, we know Pluto, you know, like Scorpio in its shadow, loves rape and sexual abuse, loves murder, has deep seething rage, deeply buried jealousy. Put them together and what do you got? You know, you've got a man,
Ted Bundy.
Yeah, who hates
Bundy.
empowered women because it means he has less control. He wants to regain that control. So he uses the powers of Pluto, manipulation, rape, and death in order to try to get that control back. And it happens with these sort of outbursts of rage where he sort of blacks out with rage and violence and then kind of comes to after. And that's sort of what, remind me her name, the woman at the mall.
Carol.
That is sort of what she described, is that he was very nice. He was very, you know, like very, everything seemed, it was a little odd, the situation, but he was very nice. And then all of a sudden in his car, he snaps. And it's like you're looking at a totally different person. And that's what we're talking about with this Mars, Pluto, Lilith. That's the way that Mars kind of takes over. And there's actually more to that. And I'll get there in a second. But I do want to say, like, this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the Chiron wound. So let's go back to that. Homeboy has Chiron in Scorpio. His deepest wound is around not having control, seething rage, sexual trauma. Guess who never worked on his deepest wound, you know? And this is what can happen. And it's no mistake that he has Chiron in Scorpio. Pluto is a planetary ruler of Scorpio, and Pluto has a very strong relationship to the moon and Lilith in Bundy's chart. Not a fucking coincidence, dudes. Okay. I'll get back to Pluto in a minute, but first I want to talk about Uranus, because Uranus is up in here too, trying to get a piece. So Uranus is in Gemini and is opposing the moon and Mars and Lilith, of course. So this is what's causing the switch flip thing that he has going on, where he can be like
the really face thing.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Uranus. Yes. Uranus is a planet of shocks, of surprises, of knee-jerk reactions coming out of nowhere. And it's in Gemini, which is the sign of duality and sometimes duplicity. I'm one way here. I'm a totally different way over here. So he's like, oh, I'm so nice. I'm just a nice white lawyer man. So refined, so smart, dashing good looks. But when that Uranus in Gemini switch flips and it hits that Mars, Moon, Lilith button, you're dealing with a totally different person. Now rage, now violence, now raping women, now murder. Okay. One other thing before I move back to Pluto, Bundy also has Neptune in the third house, which we've seen before, but I can't remember whose chart it was. The third house is a house of communication, and Neptune in its shadow is about conning people. It's the planet of being a fat, fat liar. So you have liar planet in the house of communication. Add that onto having his son in the fifth house of make-believe, you've got someone who can lie and con their way through just about anything.
I wonder if it was OJ. That sounds like an OJ thing.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember. But this is very game show hosty feeling.
That's why I thought it was OJ.
Yeah, like someone who yeah, is just very charismatic and like...
Oh, but it could have been Jim Jones too.
Yeah, that's what I think. I have to look back on it. I can't remember exactly. Okay. Let's talk about Pluto. Like Kurt Cobain and like OJ Simpson, Bundy has Pluto in the first house. Like OJ Simpson, he has Pluto in the first house in Leo. So remember when we talked about that in OJ Simpson, in his chart, Leo in the first house is the ego on ego sandwich.
Yes.
Like, could I just get some ego on top of my ego?
On top of my ego?
On
with
sourdough?
A little side of ego?
Please. Yeah. Some ego sauce?
A little ego on that, please.
Throw on my ego sandwich? Mm-hmm. Well, here we are again. Just zoom back on into narcissist territory, which is not a fucking surprise that this guy's obviously a malignant narcissist based on his chart. Okay. So we're in the first house. First house is all about how people see you, how you interact with the outside world. And we've got it in Leo, which, yes, is narcissism city, but also is very charismatic and likable, which checks out. Same with OJ Simpson, very charismatic and likable. And then we have Pluto, also in the first house. Well, there's a fucking shock. Your identity and the way that people see you is imprinted by death and rage and trauma and rape. Yeah, 100%. That's how people think of Ted Bundy.
It's going to be your legacy, son.
But, and here's what's also so interesting, because we fucking saw this in OJ Simpson's chart too, is that Pluto is conjunct Saturn, planet of the government, courts, and prison.
Oh, interesting.
So, yes. So not only was there a very famous trial that is inseparable from Bundy's identity due to him murdering people, aka Pluto, but also he was killed. He was given the death penalty. And that is also a huge part of his identity and is wrapped up in how people see him. So that's basically everything. But here's one little thing that I see that I want to call out. So we've seen some crazy ass charts with some wild configurations in them, like the anvil that we saw in Jose Menendez's chart, the envelope in Lyle.
Which one? One of those? I remember one of those was like, you were like, guess whose charts is it? And it was, and you're like, I never see. Oh no, that was the finger of God.
Was that it the finger of God? Yeah, that finger in God of God in Lyle Menendez's chart. Did I say the finger in God?
I was going to say, no, it sounded like you said the finger in God. I'm like, this is not a thing I want to be
doing. God. Listen.
Yeah. I have to fight for my life every day. For my spot in heaven. Please don't make it any harder.
I mean,
yeah, but that was the one that you were like, guess who else has it? And it turned out it was like in his whole family.
Right. Well, it wasn't in his whole family, but it was like,
it was like all of the people who, like, all of the royal family had it, and then also Prince randomly had a yacht. But here's the thing, Bundy doesn't have any of that, but he does have a T-square. And some
I thought T-squares were supposed to be good.
They can be. Right. Generally, if you're looking at a murderer's chart, probably not. But no, but we've seen them many times, and we essentially so let's review them. And I'll start by saying some astrologers would say it's kind of a cheat, this one, because it's using the north and south nodes, which are always 180 degrees apart, but I don't care. I'm saying it's legit. To review what a T-square is, in astrology, that's when you have two placements that are 180 degrees apart from each other. And then you have a third placement that's squaring both of those other placements. So in other words, it's
90 degrees from the other. Yeah. Okay. So what's the one squaring?
Okay. So the two placements that are 180 degrees apart from each other, they represent the conflict or the tension. And then sometimes this can be a creative tension, you know, for someone who has maybe a more chill chart. And then that top planet, the third one, represents where the resolution lies for the tension. And so interesting, we saw this same T-square in Lizzie Borden's chart. So let's look at it. The nodes of destiny. Remember, we have the south node conjunct his sun in Sagittarius. Well, the opposite of Sag, or what's across, it's not the opposite, but what's across from Sag, that it's known as the axis in astrology, is Gemini, which means that his north node is in Gemini. So that means Gemini is what he's meant to go toward in this lifetime. Gemini is about learning, communicating information, writing, teaching, broadcasting. That's where he was supposed to go. So those two things are at odds. That's where the tension lies, between the path he's meant to take and the path that he's not meant to take, which is the path he actually...
I mean, is anyone supposed to take his path? Like, is there someone out there who's like, the universe is like, listen, like, this is going to be rough.
Look, but this is a chart is like a snapshot of karmic cosmic information, right? So like, it's essentially like, it's a very abstract thing, right? This isn't literal, which means that when someone's born, there's no, it's not like this is exactly what's going to happen in this person's life at every moment.
Right. We've been over this a lot. Yeah. Nothing's predestined.
It's just an abstraction. So in the abstract, there is a massive tension between moving forward in your life and being stuck in what doesn't work. And I don't want to say that it's like it ends up being evil. And a lot of that has to do with the rest of his chart. But and the South Node doesn't represent evil, but here it does.
we're just going to come out and say it here.
Yeah, it does. But overall, what this North and South Node tension here is about is like either you move forward or you choose to stay in old patterns that don't.
So it's like progress or stagnation.
Yeah, sure. That's one way to look at it. And so this third piece is where the resolution lies between the two. So just guess what the third planet
don't
is.
Don't be Scorpio. Don't be Scorpio.
It's not a sign. It's a planet.
Oh, it's a planet. Oh, Is it going to be Pluto or Jupiter?
It is literally Pluto. It is okay. Literally.
I had a Pluto, feeling.
The planet that is associated with Scorpio.
Yep. That, saw that coming.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean about this just being like serial killer 101 astrology. You know, it's just like so basic and in your face. The resolution to the tension is Pluto. So yes, the tension resolves itself in these murders. This tension going on inside him resolves itself in murder and trauma and rape. But also, finally, because Pluto, remember, is conjunct Saturn,
the tension resolves itself in Bundy being imprisoned for these murders and eventually for being killed himself, Pluto, within the prison system, Saturn. And that, my friends, is the astrology of Ted Bundy.
You know, I thought about that because he spoke a little bit, not much, or at least those that he spoke to didn't talk about it too much, about how this was an impulse, like an irresistible impulse.
And that's that Pluto compulsion, addiction. That's Pluto. And that's...
Yeah. The dark instincts. Yeah. But I wondered, like, all right, your bitch ass got locked up and they just went away. Like, you didn't like what
I'm so curious what it feels like.
Did you cut yourself? Did you stab a book? Like, what are you like? I'm assuming that they didn't go away. What did you do? I don't know. I mean, he escaped and then killed people. There's that.
Yeah.
So
that's the thing about, and this is again, like, yeah, look, we all have Pluto. We're not all fucking murderers. And in fact, like, I have Pluto conjunct my moon and I have Pluto conjunct Lilith.
Yeah, but you do the work.
Well, I've done a ton of therapy, but never, it's not like before I was going to therapy, I was murdering people. But Pluto, again, like, looking at this chart, this Chiron and Scorpio is gnar, dude. And I think a lot of people don't really look at Chiron. Like, it's not a planet, for one thing.
Which is interesting because we focus on it so hard.
Because it's such a huge play. It's such a key player. And people just, like, it's not a planet. So people don't think about it. But, like, for example, when I told you I looked at Dahmer's chart.
Yeah.
He has Pluto opposite Chiron. Just directly fucking opposing each other. Yeah. No shit. Like, Chiron is such a major player. And I don't remember the rest of his chart. And I actually don't remember where Chiron was, but Chiron and Scorpio is a big,
we can do him at some point if you want.
I absolutely think we should. However, like,
not next though. I need something. I need a palate cleanser.
Yeah. I need to, like, cleanse, like, it's so disgusting and awful. And it's obviously worse for you because you're doing all of that research and reading all of that.
Well, you did. I'm sure you noticed on Netflix that I'm like, I've just been binging 30 Rock for 2 days. Like, I'm just going to need to be like, there ain't no party like a Liz Lemon party, because a Liz Lemon party is mandatory. it's like, la, 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 la. That's where my head's at right now. Because it has
fucking
to be.
Long live 30 Rock. The other one that's my palate cleanser that I go back to constantly is New Girl, which I never watched.
I know you love that show.
When it was on TV, I was like, looks just like a stupid, but it's
really
so funny.
And smart.
So smart. It's so smart. It's really good. So highly recommend if you're feeling like you need to throw up after listening to our podcast or any, if you're listening to ours, you're probably listening to other true crime and it's gnar out there, dude.
Well, and I've had, you know, and I feel like if you listen to, like, My Favorite Murder, you obviously are aware that there are people out there that find it offensive that people will talk about these things in the context of being funny. And I get that reaction, but I also don't care because I'm like, you know, the thing is, this is how, and we've discussed this before, as women, if you're walking around as a woman in the world, you are consciously aware that at all times there's a possibility that something bad is going to happen to you. That's the reality that we walk around with. And it was funny.
If you're not, you should be.
I mean, if you're not, I'm happy for you. But my instinct is that eventually you will be, because we all learn that lesson one way or another.
Yeah.
At some point in our lives, most of us do. And I remember talking to a male friend who was like, what are the things that, like, if you were walking around, like, what do you, I'm like, okay, well, for starters, like, I walk around with my keys between my fingers. I park next to an island or a cart return so that no one can park next to me. I will never, ever park next to a van. I don't care what color it is. I don't care if it's bright fucking purple. You know, like, I won't park next to an ice cream truck. That shit just looks suspicious as fuck to me.
Yeah.
I don't walk around at night.
I'm about to drive to LA and I woke up in the middle of the night the other night, just with this vision of my car breaking down. Cause now it gets dark at like 4:30.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be like on the way from Arizona to LA, you go through this huge stretch of desert where there's nothing,
no reception. Either.
There's no reception. There are no call boxes and there's a prison. There's a prison.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, there's a prison on the 10. So I woke up at like 5 a.m. and just had this vision of my car breaking down on that stretch. And then being like, what would I even do? Could I even call AAA if I don't have reception? B, what if I did? And the tow truck guy, and then I have to get in the car with the tow truck guy. And what if he murders? Like, I could not go back to sleep for hours. I was so freaked out. And all of that's just to say, you know, chances are I'll be all right. But these are things that we have to think about.
Yeah. I mean, it's scary and it's just a part of our daily lives. And it's like, and because men like Ted Bundy exist in the world, or at least existed, they say that there are 50 serial killers operating all the time in the US. And that's shit that keeps me up at night, particularly when you drive from Arizona to LA, which is why I need you to text me like 50 times.
Yeah. What's the thing where your iPhone is where I am at all times?
Yeah. Turn it on. The iPhone locator.
Let's do the thing.
The sharing location.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Let's
do that.
That's
the one. We'll do that.
Okay.
And on that note,
yeah,
let's end this Mercury retrograde filled episode.
Goddamn, you guys have no idea what we've been through.
The suffering.
just trying to get a fucking episode out there. Wow.
We do it though.
We don't know who we're doing next, do we?
You are supposed to keep this list. I have children and you keep the list.
Okay. So, well, I do have the list, but I have not memorized the list. So,
all right. Well, it won't be Dahmer. I'm going to need someone a little less low key.
No. Someone less low key. We're going to.
No. Someone less, someone low key. someone less.
Way less.
People-ish.
Yeah.
Someone where I don't have to worry that like someone
who doesn't rub a scalp off a corpse till it falls off.
The washing the hair part, that was pretty disturbing.
So disturbing. All right. Anyway, we'll figure it out. Love you.
Love you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.